You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
And the Bahamas, bigger than the Cayman Islands, namely the United States of America, including states like Nevada. This is a huge thing, and I think you have to go back to the statement of Henry Kissinger back in the 70s, where he said, if you control money, you control the entire world.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics, and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss his article, The Sinister Agenda Behind the War on Cash, USAID's role in the outlawing of most currency in India, the U.S. as the new tax haven, and an attack on the euro. William Engdahl, good to have you back again.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Bonnie.
In The Sinister Agenda Behind the War on Cash, you write that overnight, Narendra Modi's government in India de facto outlawed an estimated 86% of all cash in circulation by value. That would be 86% of the value of all money in circulation was withdrawn. His surprise announcement was on November 8th, 2016. What exactly has the Indian government done?
This is the most destructive and bizarre act of a state that I can think of in recent history in terms of monetary policy. And what they're doing is forcing people to turn in their 1,000 rupee notes and 500 rupee notes. Now, 1,000 rupee in Western dollar terms is about $15. Most of the Indian economy is informal economy. People, Indians don't trust banks, rightly so. The country is on the upper echelons of the, you know, comparative corruption indices, Transparency International, whatever measures you want to take. It's a very corrupt culture. And certainly the political side of that is extremely corrupt. So people don't trust banks to safeguard their money. They use cash. And the vast part of the economy is a cash economy. So by outlawing, this would be the equivalent of the U.S. Treasury in Trump administration outlawing all cash notes larger than a $10 bill, something like that. And how would you react to that? Oh, $20 bill, $100 bill, you know, $50. You have to bring it into the bank, and you may or may not get the equivalent in $10 bills back, or you just have to depend on electronic digital banking. And Modi, he did a tricky thing. He began by justifying it as a crackdown on the illegal economy. This is nonsense. Then he came out a little more honestly and said he wants to push the backward Indian people in the villages and the countryside and so forth to get on board digital banking. Well, this is very interesting because it's, as I dug into it, I was just flabbergasted when I read the reports back in November. And as I finally had time to dig into it in some real depth, I found out that the whole scenario of the war on cash of Modi came from the United States Agency for International Development, a cutout for the CIA. And then I wasn't so surprised when I read State Department spokesman Mark Toner back in December at a press briefing. He praised the Modi demonization, saying, this was, we believe, this is a quote, we believe an important and necessary step to crack down on illegal actions, a necessary one to address the corruption. Well, what it's done is bankrupted tens of thousands of small shop owners, creating, you know, huge unemployment. But Modi simply seems not to care. He doesn't give a damn about his people. He just, you know, he's there for maybe personal enrichment. I don't know. I had higher hopes when Modi came into the BRICS in a positive way and started talking with China and Russia and so forth. I thought, okay, maybe this is a, you know, a good development for the Eurasian economic unity. But what India has been doing recently indicates that he simply either lost it or he has been a front for Washington all along.
Well, I read somewhere that half of the people in India don't have electricity or running water. How are these people supposed to go digital?
Well, that's the thing. And half of the people, there's a beautiful word that the USAID prepared all the papers on. This is an incredible thing. It's a Washington project to destroy the Indian economy. And they wrote a report back in January last year called Beyond Cash, Why India Loves Cash and Why That Matters for what they call financial inclusion. And all that word inclusion means is one of those nonsense words that's so popular among some people these days. Means getting all Indians into the digital banking system where every single payment can be electronically tracked, given to the government tax authorities or whoever the government sees fit. You can track every purchase that I make. You know, if I decide to go to Russia on holiday, that's going to be tracked by the FBI or the CIA or somebody, Homeland Security. Or if I decide to do this or buy that, then it comes a knock on the door and say, why were you buying this and what about that? And in India, almost no retail transactions are done in digital bank transfers. 97% are done in cash or in checks. And only 11% use debit cards to pay. And only 6% of Indian shopkeepers accept digital payments. 94% don't accept them. And only 29% of bank accounts have been used in the last 3 months. Indians don't use banks. It's not like the United States. It's a third world country. And to impose this on them. Now, the interesting thing is, who's behind this USAID initiative? And there I found something called the Global Innovation Exchange. Now, what in the world is the Global Innovation Exchange, Bonnie? Well, it turns out it's an organization set up by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who are always there on the front lines of doing good for people in this world, always there with an arm around the helpless and the poor and the needy to give them GMO, Monsanto food products in Africa with the Green Revolution, or what will you? So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is in there on the Modi cash war. U.S. Department of Commerce is in there, UNICEF, United Nations Development Program, and something really weird, a spooky McLean, Virginia military contractor called MITRE Corporation, whose chairman used to be former CIA director James Schlesinger, close friend of Henry Kissinger. So this is really getting beyond bizarre. And then there's another organization called Project Catalyst of the USAID, which partnered with the Indian Finance Ministry. And there, not only the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, again, putting their arms around the poor and the needy and anybody who needs a helping hand in this world, our Visa, MasterCard, Omidyar Network of eBay billionaire founder Pierre Omidyar, the World Economic Forum, this gargantuan multi-billion-dollar thing of the globalization annual Alpine meetings, and something called the Better Than Cash Alliance. The Better Than Cash Alliance, what is that? It's based in Washington, is cooperating with the Indian finance ministry, and it seems to be the key public driver of this war on cash. So this thing stinks to high heaven, and then you find that key Western financial mucky-mucks like Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary who repealed Glass-Steagall under Bill Clinton, and who played a very shady role in the 1990s rape of Russia through his Harvard cronies, is now calling for eliminating the U.S. $100 bill. It's just like what's going on in India. It's the first step. And in Germany, in the Eurozone, the European Central Bank is calling for eliminating the 500 euro note. The same thing. And they're saying this will make consumers much more efficient in terms of moving money around and But in fact, it's the most totalitarian thing you can imagine. Every move you make, everything you buy, will be monitored by Big Brother, and that's the war on cash.
Well, as well, when we talk about India, and obviously they're using India as their first guinea pig, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
I guess they must figure that if they can pull it off in India, they could pull it off anywhere, because India's not prepared for this.
Yeah.
Is this a recipe to kill off a bunch of the population? I'm reminded of this idea that's been floating around for a few years now of depopulation. Could this be part of it?
It could well be, although I'm not sure that that's the uppermost part of it. Other countries are well along the road of outlawing cash, among them Sweden in the European Union. There you almost have difficulty to find a retailer that will accept cash, only credit cards or bank cards. It started about 2 years ago after a Davos World Economic Forum where this was one of the subjects. And I think it has to do with driving money offshore into the world's biggest, now today, believe this or not, the world's biggest bank secrecy holding country, bigger than Switzerland, bigger than the Bahamas, bigger than the Cayman Islands or the Gibraltar or Jersey Islands, namely the United States of America, including Las Vegas, states like Nevada and North Dakota, South Dakota. So this is a huge thing, and I think you have to go back to the statement of Henry Kissinger back in the 70s, where he said, if you control money, you control the entire world. And if you can get all that money into banks and get everybody going digital, then look what you can do with the digital bank accounts. You can do anything you want with people's money. So this is 1984 on steroids, in my view.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You mentioned that in 2010, the U.S. passed a law, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, or FATCA, that requires financial firms to disclose foreign accounts held by U.S. citizens and report them to the U.S. IRS tax office, or else the foreign banks would face steep penalties. Now, when I was living in France around that time, I went to a Democratic Club meeting in Nice for Americans living abroad, and they were discussing this.
Uh-huh.
Americans living abroad there were renouncing their U.S. citizenship and or moving their money, I think, to Monaco. But you write that the United States domestically is one of the very few countries that do not require these bank disclosure rules. How do you interpret this?
Very simple. Well, the United States is in very good company not adopting FATCA. The other countries that have refused are Nauru, a money laundering center, Ireland, Vanuatu, and Bahrain. So there you have it. And very simply, we want to impose that on the rest of the world, but we want to open the United States banking system as an offshore banking system. And I think this is a very, very major part of the so-called Panama Papers scandal back last May 2016, that it was designed to panic big money holders who thought they were secure offshore, you know, many of them quite legitimate. If you have an offshore account, it doesn't mean you're a criminal. But they want privacy with their money, and they don't want Uncle Sam snooping about it. Well, after the Panama Papers scandal, money started flowing out of Swiss numbered bank accounts into Reno, Nevada. The business has become so big that the great London bank, M.M. Rothschild & Co., has set up an office in Reno, Nevada. You know, this is something very big going on here. So I think as long as the dollar is the world currency of reference, the U.S. government has enormous power over everybody in the non-cash financial system and make everyone obey American law rather than their international or German law. And look at what they did recently with Germany's largest bank, Deutsche Bank. The U.S. government, unprecedented. First, they were going to impose a $3 billion fine for illegal dealings and dumping subprime mortgages back in 2007, 2008, which they did. Ackerman, then the chairman of Deutsche Bank, bragged about it on German television. By the way, Ackerman should be tried and indicted and put behind bars, in my view. He's no longer head of Deutsche Bank, but he's the one who ruined Deutsche Bank in the last 10 years, 15 years. The U.S. government then suddenly raised the fine from $3 billion to $14 billion, and Deutsche Bank was in the German media was being discussed as a candidacy for state nationalization, which may not have been the worst solution, but of course the American government, with their free market ideology, was very hard pressed to back away from that. So these are weapons that Washington has developed. You can believe that under Goldman Sachs as Treasury Secretary Mnuchin ain't going to play softball with the rest of the world. They're gonna really come down and dirty. And so this whole international bank, the factor thing is not operable for U.S. citizens inside the U.S., but the OECD took FACTA and made the OECD is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, something set up after World War II and based in Paris. But they have groups on money laundering and different things. And they established a global FACTA, far, far tougher than the American FACTA, in 2 years ago, 2014, to go after tax evasion. 97 countries have agreed to this OECD new rules, but the U.S. not, again. So we're talking about a major reorganization of global capital flows. And I think this is very much the Trump economic policy. Peter Navarro, Wilbur Ross, Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary from Goldman Sachs, and so forth.
Now, you've been talking about FACTA, and of course that's the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. When the OECD enacted these rules, is that on behalf of the governments in Europe?
Yeah, yes, not only all members of the OECD, which is a huge organization, and 97 countries have agreed to the OECD rules.
Well, that's right. So then all of the banks in all of these countries that have agreed to these rules, where do they report the accounts? Are they reporting them to the U.S. government or to their own governments?
No, to their own governments, yeah. So German accounts in Switzerland have to be reported to the German government, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of Germans have accounts, well-to-do Germans, not only, but people with life savings, and it's a saving country, have accounts in Switzerland or Liechtenstein, and they value their privacy. Some of them are tax avoiders, of course, but others simply don't want Big Brother knowing what they're doing with their money, and I don't blame them.
So now what is going on with regard to people who are using the U.S. as a tax haven, say, like you pointed out, in Las Vegas, Nevada, or you've written about a few other states in the U.S.? Are people that are putting their money into the United States then not required to report it to the U.S. government and also to their own government? So the U.S. is not going to report this. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my understanding, and that's pretty incredible. The director of Rothschild & Company in the U.S., Andrew Penny, made the comment that the United States today is, quote, effectively the biggest tax haven in the world. Tax haven is where you don't pay taxes because you don't declare it. So, and it's interesting they picked Nevada, Rothschild, because Nevada was set up with legalized gambling back during the Depression by Meyer Lansky, the head of Murder Incorporated, as to become the new Switzerland.
What is Project Catalyst, or Catalyst, Inclusive Cashless Payment Partnership? Now, that is an initiative of USAID, isn't it? You mentioned some of these other organizations.
Yeah, the Project Catalyst is a USAID project in cooperation with the Indian Finance Ministry, and it includes the names I mentioned earlier: Visa, MasterCard, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, USAID, eBay founder Pierre Omidyar, the World Economic Forum of Davos, and something called the Better Than Cash Alliance, which is one of the key figures in the war on cash. By the way, let me just add an addendum. The Better Than Cash Alliance, I mean, there's so many groups they spin off, you get dizzy here. But the Better Than Cash Alliance has some 50 members. In addition to the Gates Foundation, it includes something called the Citi Foundation of Citigroup Bank, Ford Foundation, which is tightly connected with the CIA historically, MasterCard, United States Agency for International Development, and Visa. So, you know, this is big, big, big. They're trying to go for global control. I don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to blow up in their face, frankly. But they're trying.
Well, I hope you're right. Now, there's also, in addition to, now you've mentioned Project Catalyst, Global Innovation Exchange, Better Than Cash Alliance. Now, what is this cashlesscatalyst.org? That's just another piece of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's virtually no difference. It's just spin-offs, so you have a dazzling array of little front groups. It's like what the Communist Party used to do during the 30s in the United States, create all these front groups.
Is there a larger global agenda behind the demonetization or the war on cash move by the government of Modi in India? What is the larger global agenda? Now, obviously, this is a huge move on behalf of many powerful groups. Where do you think this is going, so that the U.S. can control the financial system globally? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. I'm convinced the U.S. is writing the laws. Everybody else has to obey them. If you bring your hot money into the U.S., no questions asked. If you're an American and you want to put your money in a Swiss bank account, you better be careful, boy. So it's total control. There's never been anything like this in history. You know, you could always move a little bit of cash around. Now they're reducing the amount. When I went to my German bank the other day to make a transfer to another bank of 5,000 euros, I was told that's not allowed by the new rules. Nothing above 4,999 euros is allowed to make on a single day. Or what if you're buying a house or buying a new car or something like that? So it's really a restriction of basic human freedoms, I would say. And that's where this is going. This is going toward, what can you call it, global fascism.
Wow, that's really shocking. They wouldn't even let you move 5,000 euros from one bank to another bank? That's crazy.
Yeah, in the same city. In the same city. I had to do it in two installments.
Well, as well, I mean, I'm thinking of India, but it would apply to the United States or any country. If they do away with cash, they're going to destroy huge sectors of the economy, aren't they?
In the U.S., I don't think so. In Sweden, Sweden is a very modern economy, as you know, I'm sure. And there, they've done this, and it's, Swedes are used to using their credit cards to pay for dinner, you know, to pay for a bus ticket. It's a very common thing. So it's a cultural convenience, and it's safer than carrying, you know, a few hundred Swedish crowns of cash around with you. So, it's not like India, but it's the control. It's the control. Every single thing you buy is going to be, every book you buy, every record you buy, every DVD you buy. If you go in a restaurant and do this and that, it's total profiling, even more than Facebook and Twitter and all this other social media that the CIA is behind.
It wouldn't simply be a question of running down unpaid taxes. This would be a way as well to follow political dissidents. I had a friend, her husband was going to North Korea. They were from South Korea. They were political activists with regard to North Korea. And she told me this is years ago. They knew immediately that he'd gone to North Korea because it was on his credit card.
Yeah. So it's a digital trail that every move you make, no matter where you go. And I live in Germany. I go to China. I go to Russia quite often on business. I have dear friends in both of those places and so forth. But what if the U.S. government says, okay, that's a criminal act. We know you did this on this and this date and so forth. That's just the kind of thing we're talking about. And we're going from the United States, going to... some country in Central America, and then they put that on the blacklist. You know, it's just giving too much power to Big Brother, and I'm against that fundamentally. This is a patriarchic, domina submissive system that's being foisted on us, and it's bad enough before, but this control of the money is fascism pure. No other word for it. I'm talking about Benito Mussolini corporativist fascism, where the state and the banks control trade unions, control people, control every organization from top down.
Well, now, when you said that you didn't think this war on cash ultimately was going to work, why do you say that? It seems to me that they've got such a grip on things, maybe they could make this work and just let everybody suffer.
Not in the United States. I don't think so. I think we have enough of an independent streak that when people get a whiff of what's going on, if they tried to do this overnight like in India, there would be 10 million people in the street with baseball bats going after the Treasury Department. And they haven't tried. They've been very careful so far in the U.S. for that reason, I think.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, what about in Germany and in Europe? Do you think that the people there are going... It doesn't seem to me that they would be much different than Americans in this regard.
Absolutely. You could not pull this off in Germany today. You could not pull it off. Angela Merkel pulled off this refugee thing. We love you. We're the great Germany of accepting the tired and the poor and the huddled masses. And afterwards, people said, oh, my God, what did we do? But this with the money, I tell you, the Germans have gone through two world wars in the last century in a very, very brutal way. They've lost everything several times in the hyperinflation of the 1920s, the post-war period in the late 40s and 50s. And if there's one thing the Germans will react to, it's when somebody messes with their private savings, their private money. So when this proposal came out, not from German government, but from the European Central Bank, which is headed by an Italian, Mario Draghi, former Goldman Sachs guru, the head of the Bundesbank came out and said, I don't think this is an idea that will be accepted by German people, when they wanted to eliminate the 500 euro note. So, you know, even that august institution of the finance said, it ain't going to fly here. So I don't think it will. I don't think it will.
Oh, so they haven't outlawed the $500 euro note.
No. They talk about it, but they haven't done it yet.
I see. Now, a lot of the excuse given for the war on cash is to eradicate corruption and underground economies, black money. But it's not going to have that effect, right? Because what I've heard about, particularly in India, the black money is, it's not held by little people with cash. It's all going out of the country, or it's in gold. It's
gold, yeah.
It's being controlled by the wealthy, and this is not going to affect them, right?
Not at all. That's the point, yeah. And the big money movers, dirty money movers, the drug cartels and so, they'll dance circles around this. There's no problem for them. They'll just open an account with N.M. Rothschild in Reno, Nevada, and bring their drug money profits there and take it out of Switzerland.
Now, let me clarify something about what's going on in the U.S. Obviously, the U.S. government, let's say I have a bank account, that information is available to the government, isn't it? How would these tax havens work in this country? Would it go by the states? Would they not be reporting this money to the U.S. government?
This I don't know. This we have to look at. But when they say an offshore money center, they're talking about foreign bank accounts. Let's say a German billionaire, Baron Bornemisza or Thyssen, wants to put his billions in a Reno account with N.M. Rothschild because he's afraid of Switzerland disclosure and da-da-da-da. Nobody is going to tell the Swiss government that the Baron has put his money in Reno, Nevada through N.M. Rothschild. And this is why the economic team of Donald Trump, including his new ambassador to the European Union, are talking about trillions of dollars coming into the United States in the next years. They're counting on a massive macro shift of global capital flows into the U.S. economy. And that's a huge thing. It's going to... I just completed a piece that will be posted on the Internet and on my website, williamengdahl.com, in probably the next week, about Trump's comments and Navarro, Peter Navarro, his trade advisor, comments about Germany being a currency manipulator. And I think what they're doing is preparing to destroy the euro, and it wouldn't be very hard right now. So we could talk about that for a moment if you want.
Well, I'd love to talk about that.
He has created a new position of trade czar, if you want to call it that, named Peter Navarro. And Peter Navarro is a very, very much hardliner. He's the one that recommended to scrap the Trans-Pacific TTP and the Transatlantic TTIP, or whatever it's called, and also renegotiate NAFTA. He said the Chinese are currency manipulators and they have, ruined our domestic economy and our jobs. There's certain truth to some of these statements as well, don't deny. But then now he's focused on Germany as a currency manipulator. And this is very interesting. Currency manipulator is a term used by the U.S. Treasury. It's been applied to three nations, including Japan, in the last 30, 40 years. It's very seldom used. But to accuse Germany of being a currency manipulator, Merkel responded by saying monetary policy of Germany is not controlled by Germany, but by the European Central Bank by treaty agreement. And they are independent, so we have no control even if we wanted to. And on paper, that's correct. But the reality is the European Central Bank was set up by Helmut Kohl and the Germans in 1994 to 1999 to reflect the advantage of Germany, fix forever the relation between Portugal, Italy, France, and Greece, and these countries to the advantage of Germany. So I think thereafter they're going to knock out the euro. I'm sympathetic to that in a certain way, I have to confess, because I never for once as an economist subscribe to the euro as anything positive. It's a complete misconception. It's a banker's concept of a future Europe as a superpower and not a European concept for European populations.
Well, with the euro, all of the countries lose their sovereignty, and they can't, the European countries can't issue their own debt, right? And so it is a disaster on that level. I didn't know that the European Central Bank was set up to favor Germany.
Mm-hmm. This I followed as a journalist, as a financial journalist, in great detail at the time during the 90s, going to Brussels and banking conferences and so forth, talking to almost everybody, including Hans Dietmeyer, the head of the Bundesbank at the time. The history of the euro is quite fascinating because in 1991, there was a European heads of state conference in Maastricht, Holland, by all the heads of government of the European Economic Community, it was called back then, a very loose kind of federation. And suddenly out of the blue, Helmut Kohl, who was chancellor at that time, was confronted by Italy, Britain, and France, Mitterrand of France, John Major of Britain, who replaced Thatcher, and Andreotti of Italy, three of the most cunning politicians of the European community. And they demanded of Germany, of Kohl, the surrender of the Deutschmark and the power of her Bundesbank central bank, at that time the most respected central bank in the world, to a new independent supranational structure that became known as the European Central Bank. And Kohl was completely caught off guard. I know this from people who were present as journalists there at the Maastricht talks. And Kohl was completely shocked. And he said, well, Germany's position is first we should have a political union before we can have a monetary union. And they said, no, this is how we're going to do it. If you want to have a unified Germany, Germany is going to become such a powerhouse economically that we, other European countries, want to control Germany through the European Central Bank. So in the beginning, as you can imagine, Helmut Kohl was foot-dragging on embracing the euro, or what became the euro. And then, here's the interesting part. A friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, who's an economist and a banker from Denmark, spoke at a conference in London in 1994 with Henning Christophersen. Christophersen recently passed away, so I feel at liberty to reveal this. And Christophersen was the Danish commissioner under Jacques Delors, the president of the European Commission, for economics and currency relations in the European Economic Community, primarily responsible for hammering out what became the euro. And he was privy to all the debates and discussions among the governments of the future euro. And he told this Danish friend of mine over drinks after this conference, and I know this friend very well, he didn't distort this at all, said the attitude of Germany, especially Helmut Kohl, toward introduction of a single euro has changed 180 degrees since 1991. And my friend said, why this? And he said, well, look at what's happened in European banking. Since 1991, the French banks are in the existential crisis. Credit Lyonnais, they're all in disastrous shape. Italy, the same thing. And just hanging on by a thin lifeline, which they still are, by the way. And the British banks were in their deepest real estate debt crisis. And the German banks, Deutsche Bank and the other top German banks, convinced Kohl that if Germany does it right, the euro can secure Germany at the head of Europe for the next century or more. And a little bit after this, I was at a banking conference in Frankfurt, sponsored by the Frankfurt banks, the big German banks. And the guest keynote speaker was Helmut Kohl. And I thought, okay, let's hear what he has to say. And Kohl gave the most passionate speech I'd ever heard him give on television or elsewhere, but this was in person. He said, the euro is the key to bind Europe so that no future war between European nations will be possible. And the bankers there gave him a standing ovation. In other words, Helmut Kohl was 150% behind the euro for this reason. So when Navarro and Trump start attacking German BMW imports, and threatening 35% import tariffs and so forth, they're not only talking about BMW, they're talking about the euro and Germany as a currency manipulator. And there's a certain amount of truth to that, but the deeper point is Washington under Trump is out to dismantle this eurozone as a potential threat to the dollar as world currency reserve. That's the basis for U.S. power. The dollar is currency reserve, and the U.S. military is the largest military in the world. If you lose either one of those, game up, game over. So it's a fascinating thing. The Trump economic agenda, if you read the background papers of Peter Navarro, the new trade czar, and Wilbur Ross, the new commerce secretary, they wrote it together. And look at the comments of the Trump nominee for Brussels ambassador to the EU. They're talking about the end of the euro. They're talking about going short on the euro. And this is going to be a big global shock.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Does the euro really threaten the dollar, number one, or are they trying to take it down or attack Europe so that the money from Europe would flow into the U.S.?
I think both. The euro, the reason for the Greek crisis, as I wrote at the time, back in 2010, when suddenly it was discovered that the Greek government had cheated on its Maastricht criteria for deficit and public debt, came from Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, in 2002, had set up the arrangements, the derivative arrangements, to allow the Greek government to hide their true fiscal state from Brussels so they could stay in the euro. And then suddenly that came to light. And it came to light at precisely the time the Chinese were threatening to pull out of the dollar from its treasury bonds because the U.S. debt levels were going astronomically higher under Bush and then Obama. So this was currency war. This was a U.S. currency war to eliminate the euro as an alternative to the dollar as world reserve, which it was threatening at that point to become. But now I think they just want to get rid of the euro as a potential at all. They just get the damn thing off the agenda. Let's deal with national currencies. Let's deal with the Deutschmark, French franc, and so forth. Ironically, if the European politicians weren't so damn corrupt, they could see this as an opportunity to get back from a bad deal in the beginning. But they're damn corrupt. So they're going to fight tooth and nail to hold on to this dysfunctional euro. It's a very interesting fight that's shaping up.
If the countries in Europe go back to national currencies, obviously each country could issue its own debt, et cetera. It would solve a lot of economic problems. But then the smaller countries with smaller economies, they would be more easily manipulated by Wall Street, say, wouldn't they? I mean, wouldn't they be in even more danger, perhaps?
I don't think so. Look at Greece. You know, Greece and the euro was smashed by Wall Street.
Well, that's true.
No, I think I'm very firm that borders matter. Borders, I've said this before, I think, on your program, Bonnie, but human borders matter. If somebody tries to violate my space, I'm within my rights to defend my space, especially if they try violently. And the same thing with nations. National sovereignty, I don't think, is passé. I don't think it's a relic. I think this is essential to existence on this planet, at least in the state the world is in right now. We're not so advanced that we can all treat each other as brothers in love and human beings and so forth. We just ain't there. So let's take the state of the art and say, at least let's defend our national borders. So I think it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world that would happen to Europe. De Gaulle had a vision. He called Europe of the Fatherlands. And he meant that the agreements between that time, I think 10 or 12 nations of the European Economic Community, should be between sovereign governments. It's beneficial for Germany, it's beneficial for Belgium, it's beneficial for so to eliminate border controls on this, that, and the other thing. And there's no downside. It's not beneficial to do this, so we leave that off the table. Item by item, you negotiate this as national governments. But now you have this unelected, faceless bureaucracy in Brussels. Fascism pure. I keep coming back to this word because if listeners don't know what this word means, if they know it only as an emotional word, they should look it up in detail in the historical dictionary. This is fascism pure, what exists in Brussels. There are no democratic checks and balances. The European Parliament has no democratic checks and balances. The European Commission, no democratic checks and balances. This came clear in the glyphosate controversy last summer. Glyphosate is the most widely used, you know, weed killer herbicide in the world. It's used in Monsanto Roundup. It's used in almost every. And it's been proven by the World Health Organization to be a probable carcinogen. Well, that's pretty alarming. I think if I were a responsible European Commissioner, I would say, let's put a freeze on spraying our crops and our gardens and our schools with glyphosate until we settle this question. And there were a million petitions signed by European citizens saying the same thing. There were teams of scientists that said the same thing. And the Brussels commissioner responsible for the health of the European population said, okay, we make a compromise. We renew the license for 18 months. And now it's come out in independent studies that glyphosate in micro concentrations, much smaller than is recommended by the European Union or the EPA in the U.S., causes fatty liver disease, causes horrendous health issues and death. So, you know, because it's supposedly to the benefit of farmers to keep this on the market, they allow this poison to be sprayed on our crops for another year and a half. I think this is eugenics. I think this is population reduction on a scale in Brussels. I can't come to any other conclusion. It's criminal.
if the euro were done away with and the countries of Europe went back to their nation state status, then what's going to happen with Germany?
Hopefully more sensible policies. You know, I've lived in Germany for 30 years and I've watched this country go from a rather decent, functioning consensus society to a top-down, I would call it dictatorship. Angela Merkel says, and you click your heels and you obey. And it didn't start out that way. Even Helmut Kohl was a brutal political fighter, didn't do such things. So, and Deutsche Bank, just look at that, from the assassination by the CIA of Alfred Herrhausen, the chairman of Deutsche Bank, who had a plan in 1989, and he was a close economic advisor of Helmut Kohl on the question of Eastern Europe and Russia at the collapse, the collapse of the Soviet Union. He had a project for building high-speed rail links between Berlin and Moscow. Infrastructure, economic ties. You know, if you don't have trade, you have war. And Washington said, let's have war. So they assassinated Herrhausen. The rest is history.
Yes, his name was Herrhausen, right?
Alfred Herrhausen. I heard him speak in Frankfurt several times. He was very charismatic and a brilliant man. Very educated. He had a vision for Germany and a vision for debt relief for Poland and other countries that simply Wall Street couldn't stomach.
What year was he assassinated?
He was assassinated just at the beginning of the German, when the Berlin Wall fell down. That was November 1989. And he was assassinated just a few days after that. Yeah, in the end of November. 9th of November, the wall came down, the Berlin Wall. You remember this historic event when people were dancing on the wall? And
yeah.
The people coming across. It was very moving. The symphony was playing Beethoven's Ode to Joy. And then on 30th November, outside his home, he was blown sky high. It was said by something called the Red Army faction, the terrorist group. The sophistication of that operation points to CIA and U.S. intelligence. They're the only ones who had the motive to blow him out of the picture, because he would have created an entirely different economic space between Germany and Russia. And that's something the head of Stratfor, George Friedman, said in an interview a couple of years ago, said it's been U.S. strategic policy for more than a century to prevent an alliance between Germany and Russia. And I maintain that's a very foolish policy. It was also the British policy, and it's led to two world wars. Let nations come together. You know, the United States could benefit from a thriving, healthy European economy. But they seem to, the people who are in charge in Wall Street, who've made a coup d'etat over the political institutions of America in the last 30 years, what I talk about in the Gods of Money book, they don't want that. They just want money and power.
Yes. I did have a someone on the show who talked about that assassination of Herrhausen. I'm glad you went over that. That's very important.
Mm-hmm. It was very important. It was a decisive. And a few months later, the head of the Treuhand for Helmut Kohl, the agency entrusted with reorganizing the East German communist economy, the state economy, and privatizing all these factories and workers and so forth, Detlef Rohweder, was also assassinated in his living room on a Sunday afternoon by Red Army faction. This is all CIA dirty tricks, black operations. And what that did was to just completely knock the economic policy of the German government from one of building infrastructure, something the Germans do very well, by the way, or did very well, to one of turning East Germany into a tourist attraction instead of a high technology industrial area, which everyone was expecting in Germany a year before, and turning Russia into a target for plunder, for looting.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. I always enjoy talking with you.
I've been speaking with F. William Engdahl. Today's show has been Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His book Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Visit WilliamEngdahl.com to sign up for a free bi-monthly geopolitical newsletter. That's WilliamEngdahl.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week's show is called Fat-Free Snake Oil. It's about some problems with capitalism American style. I'll take on some trivial ones, then Noam Chomsky will discuss some bigger ones, like destroying life on Earth. I hope you'll stay tuned. The American economic system has a name. Its name is very rarely spoken. Don't you find that interesting? Almost every politician in Washington apparently has sworn to support the established economic system and the system's very rich owners, even at the expense of the American people. But in their flag-waving speeches, politicians will praise the American economic system, or free enterprise, or the free market, or economic opportunity. All these are circumlocutions. No one calls the economic system in place here by its name. Even to utter the name is kind of suspect. Makes you look like a radical. Nobody seems to use the economic system's proper name except socialists, radicals, people trying to get rid of the system. The God of Moses has a proper name, and devout Jews do not speak that name. The most powerful bad wizard in the wizard world of Harry Potter has a name. Even the good wizards dare not speak his name. They refer to him as he who must not be named. The economic system that is running our lives has a name. We show our deference to it by never uttering its name. See the parallels? We never speak its name. Well, hardly ever. I will now violate this taboo on broadcast radio. I'll say goodbye now, in case I am struck dead on the spot. Thanks for listening. The economic system that has made America what it is today has a name, and that name is Voldemort. No, wait, that's Harry Potter. Capitalism. There, I've said it. Capitalism. There, I've said it twice. That's enough for today. Okay, a couple more times. There are good things you could say about capitalism, and there are bad things. Now, in the old Soviet Union, those were the bad guys, remember? In the old Soviet Union, the media could criticize a corrupt commissar for incompetence, or for theft, or for lying about the soybean harvest in the Ukraine. But the media was not allowed to criticize the general system of Soviet communism. Surprise, surprise, it's the same here in the United States. The media can denounce a particularly corrupt corporation, or its CEO, even call for his arrest and trial. Ken Lay of Enron, for example. The media can harumph that CEOs are paid too much. But they will never take a critical view of privatization, or corporations in general, or private property, let alone the whole capitalist system. The media will never, never explore questions like, is there anything good that socialism does better than capitalism? Long story short, today we're going to take a look at capitalism, American style, with the focus on some things it is doing wrong, just to add a touch of balance to the airwaves. We'll start with the apparently trivial and move to the imminent destruction of life on Earth. That's a lot of ground to cover, I know. I'll start, Noam Chomsky will finish up, and we'll see what will fit in between. Okay, here's an amusing story of capitalism run amok. It's a trivial story, but maybe suggestive. When the average American was at the height of his or her personal prosperity, that's in the 1950s and 1960s, American corporations designed, manufactured, and sold products. And everyone wanted to buy them. They were very good products, possibly excepting the automobiles. But for decades now, corporate types have been bragging that they no longer manufacture and sell products. Rather, they market brands. Except for the luxury end, the products are all cheaply made and indistinguishable. Cheaply made, indistinguishable commodities. To make up for the lack of any real choice, there are now 18 gazillion models of each product, all made in the same Chinese factory. Who cares? We're not making and selling products. We're marketing brands. Last week, my family happened to need more toothpaste. Have you bought toothpaste lately? In 1960, you had a choice. You bought Colgate or Ipana or Crest. Don't like the taste of Colgate? Okay, buy Ipana instead. Ipana is now gone and forgotten, and my shopping cart was looking kind of drab that day, so I decided to buy something in a cheerful red box, which pretty much limits you to Colgate, so what the heck. Colgate worked well enough when I was 10, so it ought to work well enough now. This should take about 3 seconds, right? Here's the shelf. I'll just grab a box of Colgate. Did I say just? Silly, silly consumer! Here, in an average-sized supermarket in an average-sized town, here is what I found on the shelf. Colgate Cavity Protection. Colgate Sparkling White. Colgate Sensitive Whitening. Colgate Sensitive Enamel Protect. Colgate Sensitive Pro Relief. Colgate Optic White Dual Action. Colgate Optic White Enamel White. Colgate Optic White Sparkling Mint. Colgate Optic White Cool Mild Mint. Colgate Total Clean Mint. Colgate Total Whitening. Colgate Total Whitening Gel. Colgate Total Mini Stripe Gel. Colgate Total Advanced Whitening. Colgate Total Advanced Fresh Whitening. Colgate Total Advanced Deep Cleaning Gum Defense. Colgate Max White. Colgate Max White with Mini Bright Strips Crystal Mint. Colgate Max Fresh. Colgate Max Fresh with Mini Breath Strips Clean Mint. Colgate Max Fresh with Mini Breath Strips Cool Mint. What? There is no Colgate Max Fresh with Mini Breath Strips Crystal Mint. The closest you can get is Colgate Max White with Mini Bright Strips Crystal Mint. Crystal Mint aside, there was also Colgate Max Clean with Smart Foam, Spearmint Blast with Whitening, Colgate Max Clean with Smart Foam, Effervescent Mint with Whitening, Colgate Pro Shield Plus Sensitivity, Colgate Tartar Protection Whitening Cool Mint, Colgate 2-in-1 Toothpaste and Mouthwash Oxygen Whitening, Colgate 2-in-1 Toothpaste and Mouthwash Whitening with Stain Lifters, Colgate Baking Soda and Peroxide Whitening Frosty Mint Stripe, and Colgate Baking Soda and Peroxide Whitening Brisk Mint. Now I know what you're thinking. Wait, that can't be all. That's only 29. And you are right. When I got home, I went to the Colgate Toothpaste webpage and found there are at least a dozen models that my local supermarket is not stocking. I am forced to do without Colgate Sensitive Pro Relief Enamel Whitening, Colgate Total Gum Defense, Colgate Total ZX Pro Shield Plus Sensitivity, Colgate Luminous Crystal Clean Mint, Colgate Triple Action Original Mint, and Colgate SpongeBob SquarePants. No, I'm not making that one up. That combines the two most trusted names in pediatric dentistry, Colgate and SpongeBob SquarePants. So what did I buy? You may be wondering. Certainly I was wondering. One feels the overwhelming tendency just to close one's eyes, reach a hand over, and grab one. Ah-ha-ha! That's just what they want you to do. If you do that, you will find that the tube you naturally reach for with your eyes closed is the most expensive model they offer. I spent another 5 minutes trying to find out which one was the cheapest, and I bought it. I stuck into my shopping cart a cheerful red box containing Colgate Bad Breath Tooth Decay with enamel softeners. That one was selling for half the price of Colgate Max Fresh with Mini Breath Strips Clean Mint. Ask for it by name, Colgate Bad Breath Tooth Decay with enamel softeners, in the convenient 1-ounce tube. And if your grocer doesn't stock it, ask him why not. And that ends this week's segment of The Savvy Shopper. Okay, I'm being silly. I admit it, that last toothpaste I just made up. Sorry. To me, a supermarket is a temple devoted to the great god of marketing. Supermarkets drive me nuts. Corporate vice presidents of marketing drive me nuts. Admittedly, 50 different models of toothpaste is trivial, but it does hint at a larger truth. There is nothing capitalists won't do if they can make a buck doing it. Next week, let's go back to the supermarket and talk about fat-free spray oil. Fat-free spray oil is 99% cooking oil, and cooking oil is all fat. How do you get fat-free oil? Easy. You just specify a serving size of 1/4 gram. I'm not making this up. Read the label. 1/4 gram. That's a spray of 1/4 second. Take a 1/4 gram of fat, round the fat content off to the nearest gram, and you get 0 grams of fat. Voila! Fat-free oil! Some marketing genius figured that one out. Didn't even need a chemist, just a lawyer. Now you can't even buy a can of spray oil that doesn't claim to be fat-free. Again, this is trivial. But trivia can be very revealing of the larger forces at work, and the larger forces at work are very scary indeed. Let's take a big jump from the trivial to the profound and insane. To make a buck for some corporation, capitalists are not just selling you fat-free snake oil, but destroying the environment of the entire planet. Noam Chomsky has spoken often on this subject. For the next 15 minutes, we'll hear a nice talk he gave on May 7th. It's titled, Wrecking Nature for Short-Term Profit. Here's a heads up about a really interesting bit of history he gets into. As you know, the American government has been rapidly scrapping the protections of liberties that have been in place starting with the Magna Carta. Scrapping habeas corpus, to cite the most obvious example. But Chomsky points out that the Magna Carta has two parts, the Charter of Liberties and the Charter of Forests. The Charter of Forests guarantees the people's free use of many natural resources. That part got scrapped by the capitalists well over a century ago. Now they're just finishing up the process of scrapping what small bits of the Magna Carta's liberties are still in place. Did you ever hear of the Charter of Forests? It was news to me. Here's Noam Chomsky on Wrecking Nature for Short-Term Profit.
Well, let me put that aside and turn to another threat to survival, and not immediate, but imminent, and you're all aware of it. It's environmental catastrophe. Now, the facts are familiar to anyone who bothers to read scientific journals, and each one is more alarming than the last one. So take a couple of very recent reports. On April 29th, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, government administration, gave its report, its latest report on ocean surface temperatures off the northeast U.S. coast. They're the highest in 150 years. Drastic effects on ecosystems keep going up. A couple of weeks before that, Science Magazine, you know, the main scientific weekly, reported, I'll quote, a study that showed that even slighter, warmer temperatures, which are less than what's anticipated in the coming years, could start melting permafrost, mainly in Siberia, which in turn will trigger the release of huge amounts of greenhouse gases, methane, much worse than carbon dioxide, that are trapped in the ice. And that'll set off escalating nonlinear processes of destruction. Geologists and archaeologists are now considering establishment of a new geological era. You know, history is broken up into geological eras. Now, the new eras they're discussing is what they're calling the Anthropocene, starting with the Industrial Revolution, which is having huge effects on the Earth. The preceding era, the Holocene, begins around 11,000 years ago, with simultaneously about the time of the rise of agriculture. And the age before that, the Pleistocene, lasted 2.5 million years. You take a look at the acceleration, and that gives an indication of the fate towards which we're careening. Meanwhile, research papers in the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, you know, super respectable, report, I'll quote, 109 countries have enacted some form of policy regarding renewable power, and 118 countries have set targets for renewable energy. In contrast, one country, the United States, has not adopted any consistent and stable set of policies at the national level to foster the use of renewable energy. Now, that's not because of public opinion. Public opinion strongly supports measures to deal with a looming crisis. U.S. public opinion, not very far from other parts of the world. And that's kind of interesting because, as I'm sure you know, there's been a massive corporate offensive here to convince the, for years, to convince the public that either there's no global warming at all, or if there is, we don't have anything to do with it, no human contribution. Now, that offensive is now escalating, accelerating right now in interesting ways because of fears in the corporate sector that the public is just too infected by scientific rationality. And that's as big a threat as, a deterrent. An interesting program being initiated by a group you may know of, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. No, sounds innocuous. It's a corporate-funded group that proposes legislation for state legislatures. You can imagine what they propose. And they got plenty of clout, given the wealth and power behind them, so a lot of these get accepted. There's a new one that's just being started. It's for K-12, kindergarten to 12th grade education programs. It's a program they're trying to convince state legislatures that they should introduce what they call balanced teaching to develop critical thinking. That sounds good. What's balanced teaching? That means, along with teaching what's called climate science, you should teach climate change denial to kindergartners and all the way up. Then they'll have critical thinking and we'll be better off. And there are a couple of states that have already adopted it, and we can expect a lot more like this. Well, let's put this aside and imagine what a future historian, assuming that there is one, and it's not obvious that there will be, but suppose there's a future historian who looks back at what's happening right before our eyes, looks back at the early 20th century, 21st century. Well, for the first time in history, humans are facing quite significant prospects of severe calamity, maybe destruction of the possibilities of decent survival as a result of actions of theirs. And it's not secret. Facts are before our eyes, and despite the efforts of the corporate sector to conceal them, most people see them. And there's a range of reactions around the world. At one extreme, there are some who are trying to act decisively to prevent possible catastrophe. At the other extreme, policies are designed to enhance the threat. While the most powerful domestic actors are undertaking major efforts to deny what's happening and to dumb down the population so they won't interfere with short-term profits. Leading the effort to intensify the likely disaster is the richest and most powerful country in world history, with incomparable advantages, along with Canada, which is in many ways even worse. Now, we're leading the effort. Leading the effort to preserve conditions in which our immediate descendants might have a decent life are the so-called primitive societies, First Nations, tribal societies, indigenous societies, aboriginal societies. That's going on all over the world. In the Western Hemisphere, for example, the countries with large indigenous populations, Bolivia and Ecuador, are pursuing efforts to introduce what they call rights of nature. We've got to protect rights of nature. Ecuador is in, they have big indigenous populations, a majority in Bolivia. They are proposing, Ecuador is an oil producer, but they're seeking aid, financial aid, from the rich countries so that they can keep the oil underground where it's supposed to be. Okay? That's the backward primitive societies. And meanwhile, here we're racing with total enthusiasm towards quick disaster. Every time Obama or anyone else talks about 100 years of energy independence, you know, as if it meant anything, what they're saying is, let's destroy the world as fast as we can. So suppose we get every drop of hydrocarbons out by fracking and tar sands and anything else you can think of. What's the world going to look like? Well, you know, not our concern. Well, that's the concern of primitive, backward people who have these sentimental ideas about rights of nature. Well, that's what a future historian will see if there is one. Well, let me just make a last comment about this. All of this, too, traces back to Magna Carta 800 years ago. Magna Carta had two components. One is the Charter of Liberties, famous one, which I discussed, the foundation of Anglo-American law, now being torn to shreds before our eyes. The other part is what was called the Charter of Forests. That was dedicated to protection of the commons from the ravages of the power centers of the day. That record is preserved for us in things like the Robin Hood myths. That's what they're about. What are the commons? Well, the commons that weren't just the forests, they were the source of sustenance for the general population, food, fuel, welfare. And there's a classic image of, it goes back to the Bible, of widows gleaning things from the commons for fuel and food. That's what the commons were. They were very carefully nurtured and protected for centuries by people like these primitive backward people today who are trying to save the planet. Now, in capitalist ethics, there's a different concept. It's called the tragedy of the commons. That's familiar. The thesis is that if common possessions are left to the population, they'll be destroyed. So you have to privatize them and put them into the hands of the Koch brothers and so on. Then they'll be protected. That's capitalist ethics. Unless common possessions are privatized, they'll be destroyed. And there's a principle behind it. It's the principle that Adam Smith described as what he called the vile maxim of the masters of mankind. Everything for ourselves and nothing for anyone else. That's the concept that has to be drilled into people's heads to make them total sociopaths. Reality is, of course, quite the opposite. Privatization leads to destruction of the commons in pursuit of the vile maxim. Well, what happened to the Charter of the Forests? That was an equal part of Magna Carta. It was dismantled with the rise of capitalism in England centuries ago by enclosures and other measures to privatize the commons. It was followed centuries later in the United States. This central part of Magna Carta has long been forgotten apart from the traditional societies that are trying to fend off the disaster that's approaching, as we and our brilliance lead the way off the cliff like the proverbial lemmings.
That's Noam Chomsky, and I am Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Further east, you can catch us on WHUS-FM in Storrs, Connecticut. You'll also find us on finer non-commercial community-supported stations in Moscow, Idaho, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Brighton, England, and who knows where else. You can catch up on the shows you missed at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes does not ask listeners for money, but if you have a couple spare bucks, please consider giving it to your friendly neighborhood non-commercial community radio station and or your friendly free non-commercial internet archive, such as radioforall.net, where you can also find this show and many others. That's radio4all.net. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising, illegitimi non carborundum. Maybe you can ride that bicycle to work after all. Why not give it a try? And ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, you'll hear the second and final part of an interview with Dr. Graham McQueen. Graham McQueen wrote an article about the results of a recent poll in the UK, part of which focused on Muslims' beliefs about 9/11. So this is the second part of that interview about this article, which was called 9/11 Truth: British Muslims Overwhelmingly Reject the Official 9/11 Story. And this was published on the website globalresearch.ca on December 29th, 2016. Graham McQueen was the founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where he taught for 30 years. He is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. McQueen holds a PhD in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University. He's the author of the book The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, which came out in 2014, and he was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings in 2011. And he's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. So let's begin with the second part of that interview. We pick up where Graham is talking about some of the terms that were used in the British poll.
So extremism is a term that's under debate in the UK for good reason. I think it should be rejected completely. But part of the reason it's being defined that way is because the people in government who are pushing this notion of extremism do not want it to be, how shall I put this, they do not want violence to be an essential part of the definition. If extremism were to mean what many people assume it means, that people are doing some kind of horrible, unjustified violence, then obviously Sherrold and Graham McQueen are extremists because we're not pushing violence. But they want us to be part of that circle, just like they want British Muslims as a whole to be in danger of this thing called extremism. So they are deliberately creating a category, and they say this, like when he was Prime Minister, Cameron publicly said that he was against all forms of extremism, including, folks, nonviolent extremism. That's his term. And what we see in this poll that I am discussing here is that the current effort by the political right in the UK is to make so-called conspiracy theories, generally undefined, okay, to make that a part of this thing called nonviolent extremism.
Yes, it's an attack on anybody who challenges the official story.
Absolutely, an attack which has a very scary direction here, because what they're really heading for, and they've got legislation in the works in the UK, is to not only make so-called conspiracy theorists, you know, like us, to not only make us taboo and somehow polluted and ridiculous and all those things which they've been trying to do all along, but to actually make it illegal to hold such opinions. It's something we need to be aware of this.
I agree, and they're also trying to attack the, quote, fake news. They're trying to get at all the alternative outlets where we can share this information. And there's talk of trying to make, quote, fake news illegal, too. So, yeah, it is a major attack. I see that. I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Yeah, it's a dangerous assault which needs to be checked. And unfortunately, mainstream media, political parties have had a fair bit of success in the West in this employment of terms like conspiracy theory. And so it's possible that they'll get some fishy law through a parliament here or there that will make it much harder for us to have freedom of expression and freedom of research and to find out and communicate the truth about our times.
I see that as a very serious attack on us also, and I'm not sure that everyone grasps that in our movement, that they understand how serious that is.
I think you're right. I think people in what's generally called the 9/11 truth movement are used to being ridiculed, but I'm not sure that most of them grasp that there's serious intent, and it's an international intent because it's going on simultaneously in several countries. It's going on in the UK. It's going on in the US. It's going on in my country, Canada, to try and make these things illegal. My colleague Tony Hall, the University of Lethbridge, was suspended without pay from his job as a tenured professor just a couple of months ago. And the charges, as far as I've seen them expressed, are vague, bordering on ridiculous. But one of them is that he engaged in conspiracy theories. Now think about that. A tenured university professor, because he engaged in conspiracy theories, he's being suspended.
And it's already starting.
Yeah, it's already starting. And so the movement definitely needs to wake up to this and to find ways of courageously and patiently doing what we have to do to fight this. So my little article, and I don't have any great hopes for that, it was a little spin-off article that I wrote while I was writing a longer piece on the political left in the West and its relationship to 9/11. Nonetheless, I wrote that little article and I thought, wow, these findings are important to me. Maybe they'll be important to other people too. So that's why I got it published on Global Research and hope people will read it and think about this.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on another element in the article that you talked about, where their argument, the people, the policy exchange, people who did this poll, that their argument seems to go like this, that Muslim terrorist groups undertake violent acts because they think Muslims are under deadly assault from the West, and they sort of imply that they're being paranoid about this and it's not really happening, and I wondered if you could speak to that.
Yeah, that's a crucial argument that they use to link so-called conspiracy theorists to terrorism. They say that Muslim terrorists have been carrying out acts of terrorism because they have this worldview where Muslims are on one side as believers and the rest of the world's on the other side as unbelievers. Whole world's divided up into two. The unbelievers are carrying out an assault on the believers. In other words, especially the West led by the U.S., carrying out an assault on Islam and Muslims. Therefore, Muslims need to respond. And they claim that so-called conspiracy theories, like the 9/11 conspiracy theory, in quotation marks, play into all this because they feed the paranoia of the world's Muslim. You know, here's a great act of mass murder carried out in the U.S. that is portrayed as done by Muslims, but it wasn't really done by Muslims, say the conspiracy theorists, who, in their political paranoia, think that the West actually did this themselves and then blamed it on Muslims. And so through this kind of long argument, you can try and claim that the 9/11, let's call it 9/11 dissent, meaning disagreeing from the official account, feeds into terrorism. And that's the argument they make. And I'm saying this is absurd on so many levels. I mean, first of all, it's not a fantasy to say that there have been attacks on Muslims. My God, since the 9/11 attacks, several countries where the majority of the population is Muslim have been assaulted very violently. And if you read, there are several studies of casualties. I won't get into them, but the numbers of dead are in the millions. The numbers of wounded are in the many millions. The numbers of homeless are huge. We can't even begin to compute the number of people driven to clinical depression, anxiety, despair, PTSD. No. I mean, this is a horrendous crime. To call this political paranoia, excuse me? So what I say in my article is, in the real world, of course these assaults have happened. And when they say, oh, but it's paranoia to think that this was done as part of a nefarious intrigue. Well, it was nefarious, and it was an intrigue. And there were conspiracies. That's with the Downing Street memo and all this other stuff that has been discovered is about. I mean, you probably know the study by the Center for Public Integrity in the United States, which counted the hundreds and hundreds of lies told by top officials in the Bush administration in the lead-up to the attack on Iraq. So, yeah, of course, they did conspire. They did lie. It was a nefarious intrigue. So then the question becomes, do Muslims have the right to respond? And I say in the article, of course they do. Now, how they respond is another matter. It doesn't have to be violent. And in fact, British Muslims clearly are not interested in that kind of response, according to this poll. But there are lots of ways you can respond to something without being violent. and they have every right to respond. My God. So, again, I just think this is such a crude, ideologically driven, polled way they've put it together. And, of course, you and I should be helping Muslims to respond nonviolently but vigorously to all this slander and killing.
Yeah. And then the other term that I always find interesting is Islamophobia, like we all are afraid of them instead of having other more hatred or racist ideas going on.
So. Yeah, I think all the terms we use for different forms of racism need to be looked at carefully. Islamophobia has been a useful term, but it means fear of Islam, and there is fear going on for sure, but there's more than fear, right? There's suspicion, there's hatred, there's deception, there's blaming. So we need to think about all these terms and what are the best terms to use.
Right, and at the very least, there's scapegoating of them. So for the events of 9/11 and the global war on terror to keep functioning, they need to keep that going, that myth going.
Yes, I completely agree. The other point is that although the findings in the poll with British Muslims are not typical of the whole world, the polls that have been done, and there's all kinds of polls on 9/11 that have been done all over the world for years now, and they're worth thinking about, because what we're led to believe in Canada, and I'm pretty sure you're led to believe the same in the U.S., is that only nutty people and fringy people generally question the official account. The great majority of people, of course, accept the official account of 9/11. Of course they do. And the other people can be shoved to one side. Well, so while I was doing this article, I began looking at the other polls, and I just wanted to briefly give you my current estimates. So I think that the total percentage of the people in the world who are willing to come out and affirm the official account of 9/11 is probably around 39%, maybe 40%. So in other words, out of 7.5 billion people in the world, about 2.9 billion accept the official narrative, probably. That's a maximum. I'm not making computations for who is a child and who's an adult here. That can all be done. These are crude figures. So what does that mean in terms of the people who are not willing to affirm the official account? Well, it's the great majority. 61%, roughly, of the world does not buy, is not willing to say they buy. And that's 4.6 billion people, okay?
That's really fascinating when you think that the corporately controlled propaganda media is telling us the opposite all the time, that still people can think for themselves and read between the lines, and that the majority don't believe what we're being fed. It's very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this really does, no matter how you interpret these figures, they certainly show that the official propagandists and mainstream media in the West have not had an unqualified success, all right? They've had success in the sense that they've managed to keep the fraud going so far. But as I often say to people, it's like holding up a lead Zeppelin. And here I'm not talking about the musical band. Uh-huh. I mean an actual, you know, big Zeppelin, a balloon made out of lead. It means what I'm trying to get at, it'll just fall down. If you're not constantly working and expending energy to keep it up, and that's the official account of 9/11. It falls apart whenever you look at it. And therefore, it's like keeping that Led Zeppelin up in the air. It takes constant work.
That's why they have this attack on, quote, fake news, because they're trying to shut down anybody who's disagreeing with them because their propaganda isn't working as well in certain areas. And I think that's why they're so upset with Donald Trump, because they don't know what, I don't think they have him under their control totally, and they don't know what he might uncover or reveal.
I agree with you on both points. I just find it bizarre at this point in history that I would say, yeah, well, who knows, maybe Trump will be,
I know.
Trump will do something good. I mean, this guy represents just about everything I fought against my whole life, right? But at the same time, it's sort of like, which imperialist do you choose? You guys weren't given very good choices. I mean, there was Bernie Sanders, but the Democratic Party, I mean, they seemed to be panicky at the thought that somebody who was actually interested in some interesting ideas might get in. So that they quickly destroyed it.
Yeah, they rigged the primaries on that, of what the evidence seems to show. So But now they've got Donald Trump, and I agree with you. I didn't vote for him, and I've worked against what he says all my life, too, but he's starting to say some interesting things, so who knows?
Yeah, especially on the whole, well, on several areas, but on Russia, if he's willing to have peaceful coexistence, my God, to prevent a nuclear war, for God's sake. For a different essay I have to write, I've been reading over stuff from my past and realizing how much of my adult life I spent wallowing in the Cold War and how great it was when that was temporarily over. But it wasn't over for long. You know, Russia didn't understand its role. Its role was to roll over and be dead and stay dead. And it didn't do that. And U.S. elites are so angry about that. What do you mean you're not dead? What do you mean you actually think you might have regional interests and some international influence? And so they're pushing, and they're pushing, and they're pushing. And they don't, I don't know whether they don't get how dangerous it is to keep pushing Russia, or whether they kind of get off in some ways on this danger they're putting the world into. I really don't pretend to understand.
If they really want a war with Russia, yeah, I don't understand that either. It seems pretty risky to me.
Very, very risky for everybody. Yeah. Do they really think that because their kids are in private schools and because they live in a gated community that they're safe from nuclear weapons? Because if they do, they're even stupider than I think. So, you know, if Trump can lower the rhetoric there, then that's a good thing. And at this point in history, our choices are usually not between good and bad. They're usually between bad and worse, and we have to make them accordingly.
Right, I agree with you. And then if Trump can really get rid of the trade agreements like NAFTA and the TPP and all of those, I think that would be a huge benefit also.
That's right. When I saw the other day that he seemed to be calling, unless I misunderstood the article, I had to read it several times, seemed to be calling for budget cuts in the CIA. I shouldn't be laughing. When you start interfering with the operation of the U.S. intelligence community, you're putting yourself at grave risk.
Yes, even Senator Chuck Schumer said on the news, which surprised me, he said that you don't want to criticize the CIA because they have many ways of getting back at you. So he was warning him. Well, Graham, is there anything else that you wanted to discuss or that I haven't asked you in relation to your article or anything else about 9/11 or the world?
As far as the polls go, this is just fine. Thank you.
Well, Graham McQueen, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's always great to be here and have a chance to express some of these things.
And that does it for the interview with Dr. Graham McQueen on a recent article he wrote and which was posted on the highly recommended Canadian website, globalresearch.ca, on the results of a recent British poll in which only 4% of the Muslims in the UK believe the official government myth of what happened on 9/11. And now you're going to hear a short clip of Dr. Graham McQueen discussing evidence of foreknowledge of the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, the tower that was not hit by a plane on 9/11 and yet collapsed anyway.
People knew it was going to come down because they had been told that by people who were determined to bring it down. No such building has ever come down from office fires before at any time. And yet, it turns out there were people that knew within a couple of minutes of when it was going to come down. And they're on record saying, Ashley Banfield, one of the major journalists who was on the scene on World Trade 7, she basically points to the building, looks into the camera and said, I have been told that this building is the next one that's going to come down.
That building right there, the brown building, the tall one, is number 7 World Trade Center. I've heard several reports from several different officers now that that is the building that is going to go down next. In fact, one officer told me they're just waiting for that to come down at this point, that there's no way it's going to be recovered and there's no way that they can stabilize it.
CNN anchor Aaron Brown says there's another building at World Trade Center, which I've been told is either collapsing or has collapsed.
We are getting information now that one of the other buildings, Building 7 in the World Trade Center complex, is on fire and has either collapsed or is collapsing. You, to be honest, can see these pictures a little bit more clearly than I.
While CNN is showing World Trade 7 for about an hour after erroneously reporting its collapse, they have a caption at the bottom of the picture, World Trade 7 on fire, may collapse, which looks so kind of normal and reasonable that I think most viewers would think, okay, well, here's a building, it's on fire, it may collapse, what's the problem? what the viewers haven't been told at that point is that no such building, no such steel frame skyscraper in history had ever collapsed from fire. So it's not normal at all. World Trade 7 on fire may collapse. And World Trade Center 7 coming down from fire is just unheard of. So that's why I refer to this as normalizing the abnormal, you know, trying to make it look normal and reasonable when in fact it's unprecedented, it's outlandish. I mean, if it's true that World Trade 7 came down from office fire, there are just hundreds and hundreds, I suppose thousands and thousands of buildings in the world that are at risk of total disaster. And we have to be worried and we have to change the engineering curriculum in universities and the building codes and everything. And of course, we haven't, because I think the authorities are perfectly aware that it didn't come down from office fires. The BBC anchor says, you know, we're now going to confirm what we told you a couple of minutes before, namely that the Solomon Brothers building at the World Trade Center, and that's another name for World Trade 7, has indeed collapsed.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago, I was talking about the Solomon Brothers building collapsing.
And then he says, we'll go to Jane Stanley, our reporter at the scene, for more. And there's Jane.
Jane, what more can you tell us about the Solomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy.
Solemnly confirming what he says. And she's standing right in front of World Trade 7, which is clearly... it hasn't collapsed, and it isn't collapsing. When this video was discovered, I think it was 2007, and widely spread on the internet, it was quite a scandal. So the head of BBC had to eventually reply, and he said, well, if we reported this before it happened, I can assure you it's not because we were part of some conspiracy. It was not because we were told in advance of its collapse that it was going to come down. If this happened, then we can assure you it was simply an error and nothing else. For a whole bunch of reasons, it doesn't work to say this was an error. When we're asking whether Building 7 may have been deliberately brought down on 9/11, whether it might have been subjected to controlled demolition, we get called a lot of names. So we're conspiracy theorists and we're overthinking simple situations, so on and so forth. But of course, we know that the option of deliberately bringing that building down was discussed on 9/11. It's not like we made this up. There is, for example, an interview with, I believe it's a Lieutenant Restuccio in the Fire Department of New York. This is just after Building 7 comes down, and the journalist says to him, so that was Building 7 that came down, and Restuccio says, yes, indeed, it was.
Can you confirm it was number 7 that just went in?
Yes, sir.
And you guys knew this was coming all day.
We had heard reports that the building was unstable and that it eventually would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own.
Obviously, it had been discussed during the day, the possibility of bringing it down, which is why he can't exclude that option as one possibility. When people are trying to defend the official narrative of World Trade 7's collapse, they generally try to make it sound as if, well, people had a hunch, or they were worried, or they made a rational prediction that it might come down. And I'm saying none of those words, prediction, hunch, and so on, is good enough. What we actually have is foreknowledge. When we use the term foreknowledge, we should be careful, and I include three criteria. The first is what you might call a subjective state in the person who's knowing. You have to feel certain. You have to feel a high degree of confidence. So, for example, if you say, well, you know, I'm worried about that building. I have a hunch something bad might happen to it. And that's not good enough to use the term foreknowledge. But if you say, oh, it's definitely coming down, that fulfills the criterion of certainty. Second criterion is what I call confirmation. The thing you claim to know has to actually happen. Otherwise, we don't usually use the word knowledge. Even if a person was certain, we would say, well, they had a false belief or they had unjustified confidence. But if I say, I'm confident Building 7 is coming down, and lo and behold, Building 7 does come down, that's confirmation. That means my confidence was justified. And the third criterion is detail. And by that, I just mean that your knowledge of, let's say, when or the conditions under which this event is going to happen has to be fairly precise for us to use the term foreknowledge. Once we've established that there was foreknowledge of World Trade 7's collapse, by that I mean the records are quite good. We know there were a lot of people who were completely confident it was coming down. In fact, we're told there were hundreds of firefighters who were standing around for hours, and the way they put it is, we were waiting for World Trade 7 to come down. In other words, they had been told it was definitely coming down. So we know this. So there was confidence. There was confirmation. The building did come down. And there was precision. We have, again, very good records. We know that it was known within a few minutes when it was going to come down. And that's quite extraordinary because, of course, no steel skyscraper in history had ever come down from fire before. Remember, this building wasn't hit by a plane. So if this is an unprecedented event, it never happened before, and yet people are able to say within a few minutes when it was going to come down, you see what I'm saying? This is fishy, and these three criteria, confidence, confirmation, and detail, have been met. Now, once we've established that, we say, well, what are the kinds of foreknowledge that exist? And I make a distinction between two broad kinds of foreknowledge. One is evidence-based foreknowledge, and one is action-based foreknowledge. Evidence-based foreknowledge just means, you know, you look around and you gather evidence that something is going to happen, and then you make a prediction. So we could call that, if it's confirmed and is given with a lot of detail and confidence, we could call it foreknowledge. And it would be evidence-based, and there's nothing fishy about it. It happens. The second kind of foreknowledge is action-based. And all I mean by that is that the person knows something is going to happen because they're going to act to make it happen. Or, alternatively, they're aware of somebody else who's going to act to make it happen. So if I say, I know I'm going to be sitting at my desk at 8:15 tomorrow morning, I know that because I'm going to make a point of acting in such a way that I'm at my desk at 8:15. And that's a different kind of foreknowledge. And there's nothing fishy about that either. It's very common. It's great. It's not, no problem. But it can be a problem if somebody misrepresents the kind of foreknowledge that's at issue. So if I say that I'm acting on evidence-based foreknowledge when that's impossible, then we have a problem. NIST, when it came out with its final study on World Trade 7, it said, no, it didn't come down because of storage of fuel tanks in the building. It didn't come down because of damage from World Trade 1. It came down from office fire and fires that were presumably caused by the collapse of the other buildings. And they led to a whole string of really unique, peculiar events. This long span girder and this column, and one thing heats up and it pushes another thing off its seat, and that leads to this and that. And this whole strange sequence of events, which was invisible to the eye of anyone looking at the building, it all took place within the structure of the building, took place really at the very last moment, within a few minutes or even a few seconds of the actual initiation of the collapse. So that's the official government explanation of why World Trade 7 came down. There were fires. They led to peculiar, unique events that happened at the last moment. But if that's true, what point is there in talking about what some engineer thought around noon on the day, you know, 5.5 hours before the building came down, or what firefighters might have thought? And to just sum this up, what I'm saying about Building 7 is that the official government investigators are trying to get us to believe that an evidence-based prediction had been made, that there was evidence and there was a rational conclusion that Building 7 might come down, whereas in fact, when we study it carefully, we see that that does not fly. It's impossible. That in fact, we are led to the conclusion that it must have been action-based foreknowledge. Or to put it bluntly, people knew it was going to come down because they had been told that by people who were determined to bring it down. So in other words, this foreknowledge, this particular kind of foreknowledge, supports the hypothesis that World Trade 7 was brought down by controlled demolition.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Coming up, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee talks about Trump's inheritance of a vast domestic intelligence agency with extraordinary secret powers, and Trump's primetime rose a ceremony a la The Bachelor, a hoopla pick for Supreme Court Justice. What's in store for our constitutional rights?
Now, a suburban Quebec City mosque. 6 killed, 4 remain hospitalized. Our hearts are broken. The context of the attack was inescapable, coming from a rise in anti-Muslim rhetoric, behavior, and vandalism in Canada and the United States aimed at Muslims amid a heated debate about President Trump's executive order shutting U.S. borders to refugees and migrants from 7 mostly Muslim countries. Nevertheless, while debate has raged in the United States over whether to accept refugees from war-torn Syria and elsewhere, the Canadian government has become more open to people fleeing conflict in the Middle East. Trudeau has personally greeted some refugees who have entered the country and just the other day said he welcomed people who were rejected from the United States under Trump's order. But Trump's travel ban barring citizens of the 7 predominantly Muslim nations' entry into the U.S. has sparked protests throughout the U.S., and legal advocates for immigrant rights were able to get a national stay that covers those who were in transit and being detained at airports. An important first win. We're joined by Lee Gallant, Deputy Director of the Immigrant Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. He is one of the attorneys who argued on behalf of those detained in federal court. And Lee joins us now to discuss how the federal courts have stood up on the issue and whether the order is being complied with. So how are we doing with the federal courts? The ACLU participated in, I believe, 4 of the 5 cases that were brought in relationship to the exclusionary order signed by Donald Trump. Tell us more about that.
Right. I think we're doing well so far. I think the federal courts have acted in the best traditions of our federal courts. If you go back throughout history, I think what you see is the federal courts generally standing up very strong. There's been at times they've been slower than at other times, quicker in other times, but generally speaking, they've stood up. And I think all of the judges who looked at the Trump order ruled against the government in some way or another. It's at this point only temporary, but I think it's very important. The Trump order went into effect late Friday afternoon. By Saturday night, I was arguing the case in Brooklyn Federal Court, and we got a stay by 9 o'clock, a nationwide blocking of the order. That's 28 hours. And so I think that's heartening.
I just want to, before we even talk about its enforcement, there are people like Asa Hutcha from Arkansas and folks like Christie who said, look, the only real issue is this in fact, it is not a Muslim ban. This is to protect people against terrorism. It may have been inartfully rolled out, but there is no intent to discriminate or siphon out a particular faith-based group or ethnicity. Your thoughts on that and how you really are going to argue that there is intentional discrimination right here and unconstitutional when you seek a permanent injunction. The case does have to go back to court.
Right. We do believe it's a Muslim ban. We believe the intent was to disfavor Muslims, to discriminate against Muslims, and to favor other religions, and in particular Christians. That is antithetical to our values. It's antithetical to the Constitution. Over and over and over, Mr. Trump talked about banning Muslims. At the end, he was told, oh, take out a few words and it'll be legally fine. It doesn't work like that. The courts won't be so easily fooled. They will look behind the words of the executive executive order and see all of the statements he's made that it was a Muslim ban. The other thing I would note is even on its face, it violates the First Amendment because it distinguishes between religions, minority religions, majority religions. There's just too much entanglement with religion, and more particularly, there's an anti-Muslim bias that was behind the executive order, and we believe we'll prove that in court.
I just want to delve a little deeper to help educate ourselves against what is the increasing rhetoric, certainly from those who are defenders of the Trump administration and the exclusion order, that the motivation behind the executive order was discriminatory. A Muslim ban wrapped in a really paper-thin national security rationale. Can they retool it a bit and distract from that reality? I mean, isn't it extremely hard to, and don't you have to show intent to discriminate?
Right. Well, we believe we will show that intent. We also, in the coming days, will be filing a suit with additional claims and where we do not have to show intent. But at the end of the day, I believe we will be able to show intent. There are times when there is very little evidence of intent and it becomes extremely difficult to prove it. I think this is not one of those times. We are compiling the record of his statements over, you know, the past months, and it's over and over being called a Muslim ban. And I think you saw Rudy Giuliani go out on the press and say, I told him just make a few word changes and it'll be all right. And, you know, that's too transparent. You can't just take out a few words at the very end and all of a sudden say your intent was completely different. So, you know, are we looking at a long battle in the courts potentially? Absolutely. Is it going to be easy? No. We're going to need to keep fighting. The communities are going to need to keep fighting. I think we're in a classic civil rights moment where the lawyers are going to have to be doing their work in court. The community is going to have to be coming out to support it. We're going to need the help from Congress. But we haven't seen this kind of combination of community support with the lawyers and all the sort of coalescing around different issues in a while. When I argued the case on Saturday night and came out of court, there were 1,000 people outside the courtroom, and that was just unbelievable. I think that's the critical thing, is that people were out at the airports, they were in front of the court, because the lawyers themselves in court are not going to be able to do it. It needs that kind of coalition effort.
The most recent protest in New York, which drew tens of thousands of people in support of their sister and brother immigrants, refugees, migrant mobility, was supported in full. Could you put a human face on who we are talking about and what they experienced, the actual hurt that was presented to the court? I mean, I heard about one five-year-old boy who was actually kept for maybe 30 hours and was actually handcuffed and kept from his parent. Tell us a little bit about who was subjected to and suffered damage from this exclusionary order?
Right. So it's people of all walks of life, all different people. It's older people, young people. It's people who helped our military. And, you know, the other side is trying to paint this picture of these scary individuals that we know nothing about. And take our two named plaintiffs in the case. One was an interpreter for the U.S. military. The other family worked for the U.S. military. I mean, they risked their lives for our country. They were vetted, obviously, for months and months, but beyond that, they worked for years with the U.S. military. They were given permission to come here. Their lives were in danger. They got on the plane thinking, I'm going to be able to come to America because I helped the U.S. military. They get off the plane, and the first thing they hear is, President Trump doesn't want you in our country. You know, this is not a situation where they've chosen a few particularly dangerous people to keep out of the country. It's a broad order that's keeping children out. People have helped our country, older people, and it's simply not right to sort of have this broad order, and especially because it's discriminatory against a particular religion, and that's something in our country we don't do.
Lee, what's the level of enforcement now, and do you have any idea how many people are actually still detained in U.S. airports or in legal limbo abroad or are precluded, for that matter, from travel abroad now, who were students and other people who were engaged in research projects and were all set to head off to various of the countries that are on the exclusionary list?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question, and that's precisely what we are working on, is trying to get that information. Unfortunately, we are not we're not given access to everyone. So I asked for a list in court of everyone who's being detained. The judge ordered the government to give us that list. Thus far, we have not received a complete list, and so we're going to continue to press the government and maybe have to go back to court get that list so that we can figure it out, because right now I cannot tell you precisely what's happening in all of the airports, how many people. And so we absolutely need that kind of transparency, because we will not take the administration's unilateral assertions about what's happening.
So the ultimate goal, of course, of the litigation is to challenge the legality of the order. The one thing that I think would be helpful to make clear is you indicate there is other litigation to follow. And when do you think you return to court for seeking a permanent injunction and the ultimate relief that is sought from that?
I think it'll be sometime at the end of February, beginning of March. Things are a little fluid now, but one of the things that we're trying to do is submit what's called amicus briefs in court, and that's people who want to weigh in and tell the court some different aspect. And it has been unbelievable, the outpouring of people who want to submit a brief. The universities want to submit a brief explaining what's happening. National security experts want to tell the court that this is not necessary. Law professors, faith-based groups. And so that's going to take a little time to put together, but I think we'll be back in court the beginning of March and hopefully get a ruling soon thereafter. But I expect both sides to probably appeal whatever happens.
So this is bound for the Supreme Court?
You know, it's always very hard to predict what will end up in the Supreme Court. There's too many contingencies, and, of course, the court decides what it wants to hear. But, you know, we certainly think the issues are very, very important and go to the heart of who we are as a country.
Can the administration do a kind of withdraw of some of the most overt or odious components of this document, which one of which was added by Bannon? We should also say that Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani, former mayor, was involved in some of the drafting, as was Peter King, I understand. What a group. Can they retool it a bit to take off the edge and thus kind of effectively moot your litigation?
They would have to retool it a lot, is all I would say. And, you know, we don't see any evidence of that. I mean, I don't think it would be a retooling. It would have to be basically a wholesale change.
And specifically, if you can, and I know that you've got a run and have had a very full plate in the last week, how do you encapsulate what is the most offensive component and the essence of this executive order, which of course suspended all Syrian refugees from entering the country indefinitely? Just give us some of the most odious components, just to refresh people's recollection or to make them cognizant of what it really is about.
Yeah, I think it's two things. One is we're turning our back on refugees. Every time we've turned our back on people around the world who are facing persecution or death, it's been a stain on America, and we've regretted it. Going back to turning around to St. Louis during World War II when Jews were fleeing, we've always regretted it. Turning our back on refugees is really something America should not do. And the other part is, of course, picking and choosing between religions and which ones we favor, and making these generalized assumptions that Muslims are dangerous and shouldn't come here. I think those are the two aspects that people should really be concerned with.
Well, Lee Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project, the ACLU promised us that when Donald Trump was elected president, if he tried to implement his unconstitutional and un-American policies, that they would take him to court. They did, and we, the people, won. Thanks so much for your work, for speaking to us, and we will keep in close touch with you and pay close attention to these really critical issues. The slice of the human misery that Trump has caused is just terrifying. And thanks for your work.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we've been speaking with Lee Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project, who argued of the stay that is now nationally in effect of the executive order of Donald Trump. And we are moving quickly and really continuing in some ways on the same theme. And we have Sue Udry, who is executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Defending Dissent Foundation. Now, Sue, Donald Trump, possibly to distract the public from his immigration order debacle, shifted the discussion by, I think, orchestrating the announcement earlier than planned for his nomination for the Supreme Court at 8 p.m. in prime time. That was a departure from the standard procedure in recent years in which presidents have unveiled their nominees during the middle of the work day. All that was missing was a rose, a ceremony, right out of The Bachelor. Disappointing oversight for a president who was a reality TV star and has a rose garden at his disposal. But in seriousness, your concern about Neil Gorsuch and what he portends for our constitutional rights. And thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks a lot for having me. So Neil Gorsuch is a very polished, elegant lawyer who is able to turn a phrase quite elegantly. But underneath it all, he's a rabid conservative who is an originalist. He wants to interpret the Constitution the way that it was intended, the way that it was written back in the 1700s, back when Americans could own slaves. Slaves were not considered whole people. Women were not allowed to vote. Women couldn't own property. So that gives you a little quick picture of what we're dealing with this man.
I also want you to mention one of the cases that he was played a formative role in, or a formidable role, perhaps, is the case of the Hobby Lobby case, when we were which has everything to do with women's reproductive rights and his whole view of religiosity. And perhaps he forgot the separation of church and state. But your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's so troubling. The ruling said that companies can have religion and that they can impose their religious beliefs on their employees as far as restricting health insurance to not include contraception. So this, we're not even talking about abortion. We're talking about contraception. So Hobby Lobby didn't want their insurance to cover contraception, and this was as part of the Obamacare debate, and Gorsuch ruled with the majority that indeed you can impose your religious beliefs to at least this extent on your employees. So when you take it, when you take it larger, the way that, really extreme conservatives are interpreting this idea of religious liberty is that, the baker does not need to bake a wedding cake for a gay marriage, that religious liberty doesn't mean that if you don't believe in gay marriage, you shouldn't gay marry, but that you should not have to do your job if it in any way participates in a gay marriage. And that you, as an employer, if you believe that gender is something that is determined at birth, you can discriminate against a transgender person in employment. So it's really twisting this idea of religious liberty to say that indeed employers can impose their religious beliefs on their employees.
The other thing I want to look at is Sally Yates was confirmed to her post as Deputy Attorney General in 2015, only after she had affirmed to the Senate Judiciary Committee that she would act independently from the president and vow to uphold the Constitution. Well, that same committee will get to vote on Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions, whose fingerprints are all over the executive order. Your thoughts, your concerns?
Exactly. So Jeff Sessions has been called, a Washington Post writer called him the intellectual godfather of all of Trump's hardline positions and his recent executive orders. And I think that's right. And I think that's obviously something that's got to concern us all. I think that on the one hand, Trump's firing of Yates certainly exposes him as an autocrat and as a man who will just accept no dissent. But I think that what it did, fortunately for us, is really stoke a fire underneath Senate Democrats who really need to be pushing back a hell of a lot stronger than they have been against Trump's nominees. So I think on the one hand, it was absolutely a despicable act on Trump's part. I think it might have served us pretty well to expose what an autocrat he is.
The other thing that I'm interested in, which I knew very little about until we spoke offline, and that was the really kind of new cache of documents that have been revealed through The Interceptor that have everything to do with Trump's really inheritance of a vast domestic intelligence agency with extraordinary secret powers. I want you to talk more about that.
Yeah, this is where we confront Obama's legacy in a very unflattering light. People need to understand that my organization has been around since 1960, fighting to protect the right to dissent, which, of course, anyone in power doesn't want people dissenting against them, and so they use all the tools that the government has available to silence or to dampen dissent. And one of the tools that has been kind of a constant in our government since the early 1900s is the FBI and the way that the FBI can work in a clandestine manner to undercut dissent. And we saw it, you know, people talk about J. Edgar Hoover and, you know, COINTELPRO, where they had, back in the 60s and 70s, where the FBI was blatantly trying to crush the Black Power movement and the Civil Rights movement and the anti-war movement. But what these documents from The Intercept show us is that the FBI has really very unlimited power to be able to infiltrate a religious group, such as the way they've been infiltrating mosques and Muslim student groups, and to also infiltrate the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. They need to have no evidence of or any suspicion of any wrongdoing within a group in order to infiltrate and see if they can really play the role of agents provocateur and sow discord and trouble within a movement or a religious congregation.
Sue, you're doing a lot to bring the work of The Intercept to light, these very, very important documents, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. What else can it do in terms of what is revealed by these terribly frightening, potent documents and powers being put at the disposal of the Trump administration?
What we've seen since Election Day is a massive uprising of people willing to be active, to be out in the streets, to do what they can do to resist the Trump agenda. And what the model of organizing that we pursue is to help local organizers work with their local governments to push back against the agenda. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee was founded in 2001 after the Patriot Act was passed, and we helped hundreds of towns, cities, counties, and even a few states to pass resolutions against the Patriot Act, which really pushed the boundaries of what local governments were willing to do to speak truth to the federal government. We think people need to start doing that again, and people need to really, if their city is a sanctuary city, make sure that their city sticks with that, and then really expands the notion of sanctuary city to include the Muslim community, which may not be immigrants, but which is under severe threat from the Trump federal government, including the FBI, which Trump has said he wants, you know, to be surveilling every mosque in the country, and is really stoking this anti-Muslim fervor. And so what local cities need to do, or what local activists need to do, is convince their cities and counties to have their police not participate in FBI operations, generally through the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is kind of a local body that the FBI works with local police. They need to make sure that their local police are following their local laws, or they need to impose local laws that prohibit the police from infiltrating mosques without any suspicion of any criminal activity, and to prohibit their police from surveilling the Muslim community just because they're Muslim. So there's a lot that people can do at the local level to push back against the Trump agenda, and I think that's really an opportunity for us to do what we should have been doing anyway, even under Bush and Obama, but it becomes ever more critical with Trump at the helm.
Susan Yurdry, who's going to be back with us many more times, so much to discuss. She is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Defending Dissent Foundation has alerted us to this important material that is out there on the FBI, and we've got a lot of work to do, and with allies such as Sue, we will get it done. They say get back, we say fight back. Sue, thanks for joining us. And
thanks a lot, Mimi.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you all for listening. They say get back, we say fight back. We lend our hands to struggle and stay strong.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
March because Donald Trump is normalizing indecency.
I'm here to support my trans son.
I'm not all against him, but when it comes to our LGBT and women, yes, I'm against him.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Trans people will finally count for something in Pakistan. Poland's president rejects civil marriage equality, and women walk all over Trump's agenda. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Danny Cruz.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 28, 2017. The sixth national census in Pakistan's history this March will count transgender people for the first time. Trans activist Waqar Ali filed a petition with the Lahore High Court last November charging that the South Asian nation's transgender community had been marginalized and denied fundamental rights. Including them in the sixth national census, she argued, would be a good first step toward recognition and improving their lives. Chief Justice Saeed Mansour Ali Shah agreed and ordered the federal government, the National Database and Registration Authority, and the Ministry of Interior to include the transgender community in the census. Transgender people were told to identify themselves as disabled in previous censuses.
While many transgender people in Pakistan still live in poverty, their civil rights have gradually improved in recent years. A 2011 Supreme Court ruling allowed transgender people to get identity cards showing their gender as other rather than male or female. They were also specifically given the right to vote. The following year, they were granted the right to inherit property and assets.
Times have definitely changed, but the government is a bit late in complying with the federal law that requires a census every 10 years. The last census in Pakistan was conducted in 1998. Some predict that the new count of the country's population, thought to be the world's sixth largest, will have grown by more than 50%. A Pakistani advocacy group, TransAction, believes that about 500,000 transgender people live in the country.
Polish President Andrzej Duda asked during a national radio interview this week if he thought civil marriage equality would ever come to his country, said that, unequivocally, marriage in accordance with the Polish constitution is a union between a man and a woman. He told broadcaster Republika that, I don't think that the political majority today would agree to any amendment to the constitution in this area. The president's Law and Justice Party has promoted oppressive anti-LGBT policies for many years, including being against so-called active homosexuals teaching school. According to Pink News, like its regional neighbors Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, and Slovakia, Poland offers neither civil marriage nor civil partnerships to its same-gender couples.
The Armed Forces of the Philippines announced this week that LGBT enlistees are welcome to volunteer for service as long as they act and behave with dignity and with proper care, said Chief of Public Affairs Colonel Edgard Arevalo. This is a noble profession, he added. The announcement also promised to protect out soldiers, sailors, and Marines from discrimination. Exactly what constitutes proper behavior wasn't specified. The new policy is part of the military's more inclusive effort to enlist 10,000 new recruits by the end of the year.
In other news, expressions of LGBT pride in the Arctic Circle have been banned. Activists in the Salekhard region of Vladimir Putin's Russia had planned the event for the end of January. Local officials cited the national law that bans the so-called promotion of homosexuality whenever minors could be present, saying that such a gathering would be harmful to children's health and development. Organizers of Polar Pride said that about 300 people had been expected to attend. There is one other place in the Arctic Circle that hosts an LGBT Pride celebration. The Norwegian town of Tromsø celebrates the world's northernmost pride in November. Its 10-day festival also gives crowds the chance to bask in the northern light.
The U.S. state of Utah has its own no-promo-homo law. It bans supportive discussions of LGBT people in public school curricula, classroom instruction, and student clubs. A provision cryptically outlaws advocacy of homosexuality. The LGBT groups Equality Utah and the National Center for Lesbian Rights jointly filed suit in federal court this week demanding a preliminary injunction on enforcement of those laws. They challenged the constitutionality of the laws themselves in a separate suit in October. The three plaintiffs are all Utah students. One is a boy in kindergarten who was ridiculed, burned on a hot metal slide, and beaten up by other students for wearing dresses. Administrators told the boy's mother that the law kept them from telling other kids that it was okay to be gay or gender variant. Attorneys for the plaintiffs argue that the laws create a chilling culture of silence that stigmatizes LGBTQ students and tells gay students that their sexual orientation is less valid than that of heterosexual students, and thus that they themselves are less valued. Utah officials claim that the state's school board should be immune from such lawsuits. At least eight other states have similar no-promo homo laws.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC, is suing a restaurant in Scottsdale, Arizona, for creating hostile work environments for a gay employee and an employee whom fellow workers thought was gay. The lawsuit alleges that the two waiters were repeatedly called faggot and sissy and sometimes physically assaulted by coworkers. When they reported the treatment to supervisors, they were told not to complain, lost tables and therefore tips, and were ultimately fired. The lawsuit seeks back pay and punitive damages. The EEOC has, since 2015 under the Obama administration, interpreted provisions in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that ban sex discrimination to also ban bias based on sexual orientation and gender identity. While the EEOC is an independent agency, its members are chosen by the president. Donald Trump is expected to make at least two high-level appointments to the commission during his term. There's been no comment as yet from the White House about this week's EEOC lawsuit.
The Trump administration got off to a flying, though not very LGBT-friendly, start this week, the 45th U.S. president's first full week in office. Thanks to an executive order Trump issued on January 27th, LGBT refugees fleeing ISIS death squads in Syria and Iraq will no longer find refuge in the United States. Citizens of Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen are also barred from entering the country. The move appears to be fulfilling a Trump campaign promise to ban all Muslims from entering the U.S. It's worth noting, however, that none of the violent jihadists who launched attacks in the U.S., starting with 9/11 and including the Boston Marathon bombing and the Pulse massacre in Orlando, came from any of those countries.
Another Trump executive order this week bans federal funding of international health organizations that provide abortion services. Activists and educators charge that the gag order will directly impact clinics in Kenya and Ethiopia that are among the few places in those countries that offer HIV/AIDS education. Dr. Amesh A. Adalja, a board-certified infectious disease physician at the University of Pittsburgh, told the Self.com website that this gag rule has the potential to severely curtail the path we're on to end the epidemic. It's bad public policy that can have a serious impact on the lives of people.
Trump's first address to Congress will even disrupt the scheduled four-night broadcast on ABC of When We Rise, a much-anticipated TV miniseries about the U.S. LGBT rights movement. It's written by Oscar-winning Milk screenwriter Dustin Lance Black and stars Guy Pearce, Mary Louise Parker, Rachel Griffiths, Ivory Aquino, Carrie Preston, Michael Kenneth Williams, and Jonathan Majors. Whoopi Goldberg, Rosie O'Donnell, and David Hyde Pierce are among the guest stars. Milk director Gus Van Sant helmed the first two-hour episode. When We Rise was set to run on four consecutive nights from February 27th through March 2nd. But Trump scheduled his first congressional address for February 28th, which every major TV network will be covering. So tune in for the first episode of When We Rise on February 27th. You'll then have to wait until March 1st through 3rd to see the rest of it.
And when asked directly by Chris Johnson of the LGBT Washington Blade newspaper earlier this week, Trump Press Secretary Sean Spicer said he doesn't know if the president plans to rescind Barack Obama's executive order protecting LGBT federal workers from discrimination.
But finally, Barack Obama used his last day in office to issue a presidential memorandum to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service that will help transgender people entering the country. Statements from foreign doctors will now be accepted to verify an immigrant's chosen gender if that person wants to amend their official documents. A former officer who was jailed by the Army for being gay was among dozens of people who received pardons from the president during his last week in office. The man had been unable to find work because his conviction made him a felon. The comprehensive section on LGBT rights maintained by the Obama administration has been disappeared from the WhiteHouse.gov website, as were sections on women's rights and climate change. The site now has just six sections, all promoting Trump and his policy positions: America First Energy Plan, America First Foreign Policy, Bringing Back Jobs and Growth, Making Our Military Strong Again, Trade Deals Working for All Americans, and Standing Up for Our Law Enforcement Community.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 28th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Danny Cruz.
Follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org.
Women take to the streets around the world for one of the largest global progressive demonstrations in history. But first, a master of fantasy and his story.
James Whale and his pictures, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. British-born theater and film director James Whale expressed an early interest in art. He learned to stage plays while a prisoner in World War I. In 1930, after having moved to the States, he met handsome assistant story editor David Lewis in Hollywood. They openly shared a home in Pacific Palisades for 20 years. Whale is known for directing horror films such as Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and The Invisible Man, which were all blockbuster hits for Universal Pictures. Whale retired in comfort and pursued his first love, painting. A stroke left him depleted, and he committed suicide in 1957. The 1998 film Gods and Monsters depicted a fictional account of Whale's final days. The role of James Whale was played by out actor Ian McKellen. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John Porter.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Jerry Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valanche.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens. And you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
When I blithely jumped onto a downtown bus to go to the January 21st Women's March in Los Angeles, the stressed and confused driver told me the routes were all on emergency detour. It seems that the incredible size of the march had thrown LA Metro into a panic. Who knew that some 750,000 supposedly lazy Southern Californians would show up, or that nationwide 1 in 10 people in the U.S. would respond to the call? With the help of some march-bound compatriots I met along the way, I finally made it to a subway stop several blocks away from the rally site to find the streets mobbed in every direction with women, their families, and more than a few male allies, all intent on making their opposing voices heard the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated President of the United States. If it's like this in L.A., what must it be like in Washington, I wondered. Fortunately, a couple of friends made it there.
Our nation's capital began in Los Angeles, where we boarded a plane full of like-minded women headed to the Women's March on Washington. I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Even with multiple extra trains running, we found ourselves crammed, standing room only, into the D.C. metro system in order to get to the march. The metro had a record-setting ridership eclipsed only by the 2009 inauguration of President Obama.
And so we arrived, greeted by a sea of women and men holding signs supportive of everything from Obamacare, reproductive rights, and inclusivity, with many specifically supporting the rights of the LGBTQIA community.
Of course, there were many of the familiar pink hats that have become a hallmark of the multiple women's marches that were held in solidarity around the world the same day.
And it was the only day that weekend when it didn't rain in D.C. We saw one woman with a large sign for trans equality and asked her why she was marching.
I'm here to support my trans son so that the Trump administration will have been noticed that these people have rights. And also there are a tremendous amount of trans community members are in dire needs of health care, as well as mental health care, different from just the medical health care, because 40% of transgender community at least once attempt suicide. And it's a tremendous amount of mental health care is needed. And Obamacare had really supported this community and providing them to have a better medical care and a mental care. And that we're very concerned that that particular care will go with the current administration.
Although the mood was positive and inclusive, there were clearly members of the LGBT community who had something to say about the new president, including this woman from Iowa.
I am here today at the Women's March because Donald Trump is normalizing indecency. He is indecent to women in grabbing pussies. He commits sexual assault, grabbing pussies, in kissing women who don't want to be kissed, in walking in on girls who are dressing in a dressing room. He believes in the sale of women. He believes in the categorizing women by a number. He is indecent, and he is teaching young men and boys to be indecent. He is not a leader. He is a narcissist, and he does not belong in his position.
And he is not our president. And we got all the way from Iowa just to say that.
And some who shared a different opinion.
Not all against Trump. I'm not all against him. But when it comes to our LGBT and women, yes, I'm against him.
As a trans person, what are your thoughts on the possibilities of having your rights repealed?
First of all, it will take them a long time to repeal. Even if they want to, But listen, Republicans are not stupid. There are some Republicans that are extremists. They really don't want LGBT people. Some of them have started being educated. Because I went to Trump inauguration yesterday. And I told them what I am. And people were like, they weren't attacking me. They were not. They say, it's your choice. So we respect that. So, you know, a lot of LGBT people were at the Trump, not a lot, but quite a few. So we're at the inauguration yesterday. Kylie Jenner is trans. She voted for Republicans. And some others, I mean, LGBT people vote for Trump, some of them. If they think that they're going to repeal that, those people are not going to vote for Trump again, or even Republican. Because once you fuck with our rights, you're wrong. And they're going to think twice about doing it.
The march followed a more than four-hour rally with a host of activists, celebrities, and musicians representing diverse communities and celebrating intersectional feminism. There's not enough time to bring you the heartfelt words and musical performances that emanated from the stage, but the New York Times has posted video of the entire rally that you can view in its entirety at bit.ly/premarchrally.
Even before the rally ended, the larger-than-expected crowd spilled into the parade route and even filled adjacent streets. Despite the chilly weather, there was a strong spirit of camaraderie between young and old, gay and straight, women and men, immigrants and native-born. And spontaneous chants kept the marchers engaged.
We saw only three anti-march protesters as we walked along the route. We're not certain of their exact message, but their concern seemed to be that the marchers were going to hell. As they had their say through the bullhorns they carried, the marchers surrounded them with the gentle words, "Love is love."
The Women's March on Washington inspired many others around the country and around the world, from Omaha to Dublin, Nairobi to Antarctica. What began with a grandmother in Hawaii who had an idea became a major global event.
The official webpage for the march reports over 5 million marchers around the world, with a million of them in Washington, D.C. It was indeed inspiring to be there.
But a march alone cannot achieve political objectives. The official website, www.womensmarch.com, is encouraging those who participated to continue their activism by communicating with their elected representatives and holding them accountable.
Also, to keep the momentum going, there are various groups planning more marches throughout the coming year.
For This Way Out, I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom.
Oh, no, 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 no.
We who believe cannot rest until it comes.
Well, now.
We who believe.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Every day when we wake up in the morning, we're able to exercise choice. We cannot rest until we all have that choice, that God-given choice to exercise. We cannot rest
until it comes.
Until the killing of black men, black mother's sons, is as important as the killing of a white man, a white mother's son. Oh, we who believe in freedom,
we believe in freedom cannot rest.
Cannot we who believe in freedom,
we believe in freedom cannot rest.
Tell you That which touches me most is that I have a chance to work with people, and I'm passing on to others that which was passed on to me. Woe to me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail. And if I could but shed some light as they carry us through the gale. Come on now, we who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom, cannot rest.
Cannot rest. We who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom, cannot rest.
I'll tell you, struggling myself don't mean a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand and fight, it is the only way our struggle survives. I'm a woman who speaks in a voice, and I must be heard. At times I can be quite difficult. I'll bow to no man's word. Come on now, we who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom, cannot rest.
Oh no, no, we who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom, cannot rest.
One more time now.
We who believe in freedom, cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
I believe.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Francis O'Brien, Danny Cruz, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with John Porter, and Chris Wilson and Pam Marshall contributed program material, with double thanks this week to Steve Pride. Pussy Riot and Sweet Honey in the Rock performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, the Gay Chemist Support Fund of Horizons Foundation, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who have made this program possible. It's never too late to log in to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WPRR Grand Rapids, Michigan, KPOV Bend, Oregon, 5RRR Woomera, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Donald Trump is a capitalist. On the campaign trail, he may have railed against Wall Street and denounced Goldman Sachs, but he's named or nominated a number of former Goldman Sachs bankers to positions within his administration. One of them, Treasury Secretary designate Steve Mnuchin, is a hedge fund manager. But whereas some of Trump's actions draw headlines, many things he and other capitalists like Mnuchin do, they happen under the radar, escaping our notice even though their actions have tremendous ramifications for people and communities and social and political arrangements. Max Haven is a scholar and writer who has taken the trouble to investigate little-known processes of financialization and debt. He is Canada Research Chair in Culture, Media, and Social Justice at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada, where he directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab. Last fall, Max Haven and artist Cassie Thornton conducted a walking tour of various sites in San Francisco and Oakland, a tour that explored issues that, I venture to say, matter to all people living under capitalism. A few weeks later, Max and Cassie joined me to talk about the tour, and today we present the bulk of Max's remarks during that extended conversation, remarks that address and linked up a wide range of topics and phenomena, including hedge funds, gentrification, Puerto Rico's debt, greenwashing, the foreclosure crisis, and even the wild parrots of Telegraph Hill. I asked Max what motivated the creation of the walking tour and all of the substantive material he and Cassie presented over the course of the tour.
Well, I think for both of us, it was starting to collaborate on questions of debt and credit and trying to think through finance and financialization as a collective experience, as something that doesn't just affect individuals, but that affects whole populations. And Cassie was undertaking a project at Gallery 400 at the University of Illinois at Chicago in June of 2016. And that project focused on the Chicago public schools. And in the course of that project and examining the bankruptcy of the Chicago public schools, one thing Cassie heard many times was that the situation was very similar to that in Puerto Rico. And that led us to an interest in Puerto Rico and actually eventually a visit in July and August of 2016 to Puerto Rico, which at the time was in the grips of an incredibly deep debt crisis. And, you know, our visit there was really illuminating and it was very inspiring in many ways. We met with a lot of activists who were really thinking about debt in different ways, thinking about debts as not only financial debts, but the debts of history and the debts of society, the debts that people owe one another, the debts that people owe themselves. And we came back from that project to the Bay Area. I think for me, I was deeply inspired by the question of how debt and how finance travels in ways that we don't necessarily fully imagine or fully grasp when we just take it at face value. So I was interested in the way that a debt of a country like Puerto Rico sort of swirls and eddies in the same substance, in the same waters as the debt of homeowners in Oakland or the same waters as students and teachers in Chicago. Are the same waters as, you know, the politics of international debt through the International Monetary Fund or World Bank. So I think what really inspired me towards the project was wanting to think through debt in this much deeper, more interconnected way that saw it reach out thickly and in really complex ways, not only to other forms of debt and other social institutions, but to society, to the life world, to the sort of ecosphere. I mean, when you're dealing with the topic of debt and financialization, as you look, as both Cassie and I have done over the last 6 or 7 years in our respective work, when you look at it and you begin to look at it very deeply, you begin to see that it's interconnected everywhere. One of my mentors, Randy Martin, was who unfortunately died a short while ago, talked a lot about the derivative, which is this sort of signature technology of finance today, as this technology which collapses the whole world into, and the whole world's sort of multiple futures into one financial technology, which can be used to manipulate and speculate. And so when you begin to look into finance and you begin to look into debt, it begins to spread out like the roots of a tree into all sorts of nooks and crannies. It begins to touch all sorts of different social processes, from housing to international trade to, you know, work and the effects of work and the effects of housing and the effects of changes in the cities on our bodies.
The tour began at Farallon Restaurant in San Francisco, a posh establishment one block from Union Square. Why, I asked, did the tour begin there?
So we chose Farallon Restaurant first because we actually wanted to go to the Farallon Islands, which are a group of islands about 20 miles west of the Golden Gate Bridge. And we'd selected the Farallon Islands for a number of reasons. The first was, it shared the name with Farallon Capital, which is a hedge fund that became very central to our project. It became a sort of an icon or a cipher for financialization writ large, because it owned both a huge amount of debt of the country of Puerto Rico and had been extremely instrumental in the gentrification of West Oakland. And those were two processes we wanted to compare. But we wanted to link that hedge fund to natural processes and to this sort of ecological sphere, because our project involved thinking through the question of invasive species as well. And those things came together for us around the Farallon Islands, which are a set of islands that are shrouded in sort of myth in the Bay Area that have been very central to imperialism, various imperial powers, including Russia and the United States and Spain and England over the centuries. But of course, we couldn't take all of our guests to the Farallon Islands because it's a full day trip to get out there when you have to charter a boat. So instead, we looked around for a place to begin this tour, and Farallon Restaurant presented us with a interesting venue, not only because it shared a name with the Farallon Islands and with Farallon Capital, but because it was also one of these venues that seems to be a solidification of transnational capital flows. You know, when we were doing our preparatory research in the space, we sat there for a while and watched who came in, and it tended to be international tourists. It tended to be people working in the financial industry, some people who looked like they were working in sort of the high end of arts and culture. So this is a space for us of financial reproduction. It's a space in the world where certain flows of power and wealth and sociality sort of pool.
I asked Max Haven what he stressed about processes of financialization and their impact during the presentation he and Cassie gave at Farallon Restaurant.
One of the things that has been really central to my thinking about financialization over the last few years is trying to move away from the idea that the forms of technologically driven finance that we see today, things like derivative contracts, futures, currency trading, high frequency, you know, trading algorithms, that these are somehow an aberration from or a sort of pathology of otherwise perfectly functioning markets. I think it's a very pernicious idea because actually if we look further back in history, we see that finance has always worked in the interests of imperialism and colonialism. And when we were in Puerto Rico, it just brought home again that, you know, the debt that Puerto Rico has been forced to go into over the last 30 years as a result of neoliberalism and as a result of the continued colonial presence of the United States in that country, this debt is simply the continuation of imperialism and colonialism by other means. And there's a comforting narrative we have that would say that today's hedge funds or financial apparatuses are like weeds, are like invasive species that come in and destroy an otherwise functioning capitalist economy. But in reality, the capitalist economy has always been poisonous and has always been damaging.
The tour then moved to the office building that houses Farallon Capital Management in San Francisco's financial district. Farallon Capital Management's website says it manages equity capital for institutions, including college endowments, charitable foundations, and pension plans, and for high net worth individuals. The firm, which employs about 180 people, is headquartered in San Francisco and has offices in London, Singapore, Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Sao Paulo. What should we know about Farallon Capital Management?
Farallon Capital Management became a really important character in the drama that we were unfolding. It really sits at the nexus of a set of capitalist forces that are ecologically destructive, that are imperialist and colonialist in nature, and that were really participating in the reshaping of urban space in the Bay Area. Just to back up a tiny bit, a hedge fund, for those who don't know, is essentially a elite club for very rich investors. If you want to invest in Farallon Capital, you need to have a buy-in of $5 million to put down on the table that gets you essentially to be part of this elite club of investors. And a hedge fund is an institution that specializes in accumulating extremely potent information and data and making high-risk, highly leveraged financial gambits. So they get the investments of their initial investors. They'll borrow even more money on top of that initial investment, and they'll put that into something that they think is going to be very high risk but high reward. So they're really a kind of financial shark. They operate with a sort of extreme violent efficiency in markets. And it's not a coincidence that we worked with this metaphor of the shark, because one of the things the Farallon Islands is most famous for is, in fact, the greatest, most consistent concentration of great white sharks anywhere in the world. It's one of the most scientifically significant areas to study these incredible creatures. It might actually be an injustice to sharks to liken a hedge fund to them, because a shark has its own logic. It turns out that sharks are quite sociable creatures. They have their own rhythms in nature. A hedge fund is an institution, a highly calibrated, highly torqued institution for making as much money as possible for its investors. So Farallon has about $21 billion under its management. It used to manage the endowments of a huge number of America's leading public and private universities. It has major stakes in sort of privatization schemes in Russia, in Argentina, and Indonesia. It's run or was founded by Tom Steyer, who is a very influential figure for reasons that we'll get into in a little bit later, I suspect. Who, with an initial investment in the 1980s of $15 million, by the time he retired, had a stake of $1.2 billion in Farallon Capital. And one of the things that we discovered when we were in Puerto Rico is that this hedge fund has invested quite a bit in the bonds of Puerto Rico and is one of the so-called vulture funds that bought up Puerto Rico's debt for pennies on the dollar, but is now demanding full payment to get as much money as they can out of the island. We know that Puerto Rico as a whole has something around the realm of $76 billion in debt. We can't really tell how much of that is owned by Farallon. The only information we could gather is that at very least they bought up $55 million worth of that debt and is now part of a consortium of hedge funds and vulture funds that are holding that debt over the head of the island, demanding that things like schools and things like public services be cut back in order to pay out these investors and these vulture funds. So for us, Farallon was a particularly acute example of a sort of animal or organism or species that evolved within the high-pressure ecosystem of today's financialized markets and could offer us a sort of target and also a sort of metaphor for something much larger and more interconnected.
That's Max Haven, and I'm CS, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Max Haven is a writer, educator, and movement organizer based at Lakehead University in Ontario, where he is Canada Research Chair in Culture, Media, and Social Justice. You're listening to an account of a walking tour that Max Haven and his collaborator Cassie Thornton conducted last fall in San Francisco and West Oakland, a tour during which Max spoke about all kinds of pressing issues: financialization, gentrification, and new forms of economic colonialism. A few weeks after the tour took place, Max Haven spoke with me about it. I asked Max to elaborate on how hedge funds and vulture funds operate. What kinds of debt do they try and acquire, and how do they hope to make a profit off of it?
So most governments around the world, both at the federal level and the municipal level, and then at the level of states, operate and make up their annual budget shortfalls by going into debt. Or sometimes if they have a large capital project like building a school or building a highway, they'll go into debt in order to make that possible, rather than saving up money over 20 or 30 years. And the typical way that they do that is by issuing bonds. So what will typically happen is a bond is simply a debt. It's an agreement to pay a certain amount of money at a certain point in the future with a certain rate of interest. And bonds, you know, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of different bonds circulate around the world each day. And the colony of Puerto Rico, or the autonomous economic zone, as they're called, over the last 40 years especially, has been selling more and more and more bonds to international markets, which essentially, when we say international markets, we really mean the banking and finance sector. But because Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, both its constitution and the numerous laws that the U.S. Congress has passed concerning Puerto Rico's economic status have made it essentially into a bit of a Shangri-La for investors. For instance, there's one law that states that before any other expenses are incurred by the government, they will uphold their obligation to bondholders first, which is a sort of policy that's not in place in almost any other place in the world, and certainly not in any of the other states, because it essentially means you need to pay off foreign banks before you pay teachers and police and politicians. You know, so the island of Puerto Rico had been made into this very enticing location for international banks and the people that they serve, which is like hedge funds and pension funds and insurance companies, for them to make large investments in the country. So what would essentially happen is, let's say Puerto Rico needed $100 million this year, if they weren't in an economic crisis, they would issue 100 $1 million bonds. And those $1 million bonds would say, in 10 years' time, we're going to pay you back at $1 million plus 5% per year interest. Those bonds would then be sold on to major banks, and they would in turn sell them on to their clients, pension funds, insurance companies, even retail investors like, you know, workers. But what happens is, as the government, as any government around the world, gets more and more shaky, the bonds get downgraded. And in fact, it's understood that many of those bonds won't be repaid, especially for a country that's in a deep, protracted financial crisis like Puerto Rico. And at that point, everyone who owns the bonds of Puerto Rico knows they're not going to get their original $1 million back, so they start trying to sell that bond for less than the original outlay of cash. So maybe they lent $1 million expecting they would get, you know, $1 million plus interest back, but now they're willing to sell that bond for $700,000, or they're willing to sell it for $500,000 just in the hopes of getting some money out of the deal. And eventually these bonds become so toxic that they can be bought for literally pennies on the dollar. $1 million bond of the country of Puerto Rico, or the island of Puerto Rico, could be circulating on global markets for $10,000 or $20,000, because no one believes that they're actually going to get paid. And if you are a hedge fund, what you specialize in is looking around the market and finding the easy prey. And you see that you can buy $1 million worth of Puerto Rican debt for $10,000, for basically 1% of its stated value. You snap up that bond, and then you'd go to the government of Puerto Rico and say, we want $1 million. We want the $1 million you owe us. Puerto Rico says, we can't pay. And the hedge fund, or the vulture fund in this case, says, well, give us all your money that you can pay. So you may never actually pay back that $1 million, but at least we're going to get $30,000, $40,000 for this bond out of you. And we come out $20,000 or $30,000 ahead. So it's a technique of extorting governments out of their money. And the final thing I would say about it is, you know, there are organizations like Farallon that specialize in doing this all around the world. The euphemism that they use is distressed assets. But what's really going on underneath the surface is that places like Puerto Rico should have never been forced to go into debt in the first place. The reason they were in the dire economic position that made them borrow from global markets in order to build schools and hospitals and highways was the fact that they are, first of all, a colony of the United States, and then second of all, that they've been undergoing and in fact had been forced to enthusiastically embrace the logic of neoliberalism, which means that corporations and the rich get to keep a huge proportion of their money, and governments are starved for funds, meaning that they have to go looking to the private sector, to banks, to hedge funds for the funding simply to continue to operate in the interests of their citizens. So these debts never should have been incurred, and now the debts are being used to squeeze even more money out of the population at the expense of people's health and well-being.
The walking tour then moved the block east to a park, a public space with clusters of tall trees inhabited by very loud birds. Why, I asked Max, did he and Cassie make this a stop on their tour?
Well, this park has an interesting story. It was actually the terminal of a set of highways that collapsed during the 1989 earthquake. And when that overpass was then removed, the city turned it into a park. Interestingly, a number of the trees in that park are foreign species or non-indigenous species. They're eucalyptus trees and others. And those are the favorite roosting grounds of a flock of parrots that have made San Francisco their home. These were immortalized in the film and the book, The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. They are parrots that were abducted from the rainforest in Central America and brought to North America as pets. And then they liberated themselves from their confinement and found one another and started to breed. And lo and behold, over 30 years later, there are hundreds of these parrots now that flock together. And this park is one of their key nesting grounds. And in fact, we visited in September, which is the time when the hatchlings are fledging and learning to fly. So we wanted to select this location as an example of multiple invasive species, what get termed invasive species, overlapping with one another. The trees, which have been brought to San Francisco first as ornamental trees, the parrots that were brought as pets, both of which have sort of escaped their confinement and begun to create a new ecosystem together. And we wanted to do that because in our minds, something that kind of captivated our imagination when we were in Puerto Rico and afterwards was this line between what's wild and what's common. You know, we have this idea of wildness that separates it out from humans, that makes it the outside of our sphere of influence. And we tend to try and do as much work as we can to tame what's wild and to claim what's wild and to extract what's valuable to us from what's wild. But when you see moments of rewilding in a city, as has happened with these birds, there's a way that the wild has a way of undoing the forms and structures of the economy and society that we as humans have solidified in our enthusiasm to escape from the wild. And the second part of that is about the commons. You know, there's the interesting follow-up story to the parrots is that after the release of that film, the parrots became extremely popular tourist attractions, so much so that people would go down to this park and others with food for the parrots that was in fact quite bad for them. As it turns out, you shouldn't be feeding nuts and bread to birds. It messes up their natural rhythms. Many people would come, and then the parrots would sort of land on them, and they became a charismatic sort of tourist feature of the city. What was wild became common. It became something that was free and accessible to everyone, but also something that was adding to the cultural capital and to the sort of extractive capital of the city, which had been re-groomed for tourists. And as a result, a number of the original protagonists of the birds, the people who had initially sort of spotted and protected the birds, helped the city of San Francisco pass a law that forbade the feeding of the animals so that they could, in fact, remain a wild common feature of the city and not simply become another tourist gimmick. And for us, this dynamics that we're occupying this park, which in fact exists in the shadow of Farallon's building, of that One Maritime Plaza building, really offered an opportunity to think through the multiple re-enfolding dynamics of what it means to be an invasive species, what it means to think through invasion, who's invading whom, what it means to have interspecies dialogue, that distinction between the wild and the common. And that would become very important for us to keep in mind as we move forward in the tour, to look again at the invasive presence of feral on Capitol as we would move in the next stations over to West Oakland, and as we'd begin to explore the processes of gentrification as well.
And so the tour headed across the bay, or rather underneath it on BART, to West Oakland. Max Haven and Cassie Thornton stopped with a group in front of the offices of the Sullivan Management Corporation.
Sullivan Management Company is responsible, by some estimates, for buying up 40% of the foreclosed homes in West Oakland and downtown Oakland following the 2007-2008 financial crisis. As has been recorded by a huge number of studies and NGOs in Oakland and beyond, the 2007-2008 foreclosure crisis disproportionately hit Black and brown families the hardest. And in West Oakland, a huge proportion of the families that lost their homes in this traditionally Black neighborhood were Black and brown families. And the people who benefited were largely speculators from outside of the neighborhood. So Sullivan Management Company, for instance, would typically buy an old Victorian home, some very beautiful homes in that neighborhood, for around $100,000. And 2 or 3 years later, after a very minimal renovation, would sell it for somewhere in the range of $400,000. This had the effect of really driving up to a huge extent property rates in Oakland, in West Oakland, and in the Bay Area more generally, such as we've seen over the last few years, where just in the last couple of years, rent and property prices in all three cities of Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco have increased at rates of between 15 and 30% per year, essentially driving out lower income residents, driving out really anyone who doesn't have a really well-paying tech job. SMC, the company, is a key part of this and is only one part of a constellation of small companies owned by one man whose name is Neil Sullivan. Other companies are REO Homes, which was really one of the ones that was responsible for flipping the homes and renovating them. There's a number of other groups with some variation of the acronym SMC. But what's significant for us, in addition to finding, you know, a red-handed culprit for gentrification, and one who still remains what NGOs in Oakland point to as a slum landlord, they've kept a hold of many of the homes and now rent them out for exorbitant rates, you know, to residents. The other thing that's significant, though, is that Neil Sullivan was bankrolled in this venture by Tom Steyer, the CEO of Farallon, and a number of other senior executives at Farallon as well. We don't know if Farallon Capital itself invested, but certainly a number of the high-ranking people within the company did, sensing an opportunity, taking that shark-like financial acumen that they developed at Farallon and applying it now closer to home towards this golden opportunity to buy up these foreclosed homes. Between 2009 and 2014, for instance, there were over 357 evictions just in West Oakland alone. 7% of all the homes in West Oakland were foreclosed at some point since the crisis began. And of those, 42% have ended up in the hands of investors. But that's a very conservative figure. So really, and at this point, SMC or its affiliated companies operates at least 250 units of rental housing in that neighborhood, and they've charged exorbitant rates for it. So for us, SMC represents another crystallization of what happens when liquid financial capital courses around the world like an invasive species coming up through the cracks within neighborhoods and within communities that have been caused by generations of systemic racism and systemic exploitation, and really taking advantage of a weakened ecosystem in order to maximize their own growth, growth whose energy and real wealth is being extracted out of the community and into the hands of, you know, extremely wealthy people like Tom Steyer, the CEO of Farallon, and others.
Max Haven is Canada Research Chair in Culture, Media, and Social Justice at Lakehead University in Ontario, and he's also an organizer and a writer. We'll take a short break and return with more of Max Haven's comments. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Max Haven teaches at Lakehead University, and he's the author of several books, including Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, Capitalism, Creativity, and the Commons, and with Alex Kasnabish, The Radical Imagination, Social Movement Research in the Age of Austerity. He also co-directs with Alex the Radical Imagination Project. Max Haven spoke with me last fall, a few weeks after he and his collaborator, a social practice artist named Cassie Thornton, conducted a walking tour of San Francisco and Oakland that examined the impact finance capital has on locations near and far, on people in Puerto Rico, on neighborhoods that are gentrifying, and on major party politics. We now pick back up with the tour, which proceeded along the streets of West Oakland and stopped in front of a residential building. What, I asked Max Haven, did he and Cassie find significant about the building?
Well, this house was a sort of typical project for SMC. It was an old, very beautiful Victorian house that had this kind of lumpy addition on it that was really aesthetically brutalist. And it was clear that they had seen the footprint of this property as one to extract as much value from tenants as possible. So they'd built on extra rooms to this house that looked, you know, incredibly ugly, really belying SMC's claim on their website and elsewhere that they were participating in the beautifying of a derelict neighborhood. And in fact, the whole framing of SMC's rhetoric about West Oakland being derelict, as it being an undervalued neighborhood, their whole triumphant narrative of themselves as coming in and greening the neighborhood, all of this is typical of the language, the violent language of gentrification. And what it serves to do on a fundamental level, we wanted to point out at this station, is it serves to hide or disguise who's actually producing wealth. Capitalism has always thrived like a weed on preying on the biodiversity and the economic diversity and the diversity of cooperation of workers. And gentrification, in as a sort of current day manifestation of that system, really thrives on and maximizes the extraction of the energy that people over generations have put into their neighborhood to make it a beautiful and wonderful place to live. So when gentrifiers like SMC come in and claim that they're the ones who are adding value, quote unquote, to the neighborhood, they're not only stealing the value that was already there, they're rewriting history to make themselves into the triumphant capitalist, you know, actors. And in this narrative, they could have no better teacher, in fact, than Tom Steyer, whom we mentioned before, the founding CEO of Farallon, who actually retired in, I believe, 2012. I'd need don't have the number right in front of me, but who was a really central figure in the growth of this little hedge fund from a sort of boutique investment to, as I mentioned, a hedge fund that was managing the portfolios of major public institutions like universities and really a major player in financial markets. Steyer was an alumnus of Goldman Sachs and a variety of other investment banks. But interestingly, once he became the CEO of Farallon, he began to develop, at least on the surface, a sort of green consciousness, though especially since his retirement. But even in the years preceding that, he really wanted to put himself forward as kind of the Democratic Party answer to the Koch brothers, this enlightened billionaire who was going to use his money without apology to influence politics. He was a major, major fundraiser for and donate and gave many, many donations to the Democratic Party. When Obama came to do fundraising in San Francisco in 2014, that event was held at Tom Steyer's house. Tom Steyer and his wife run together a ranch for ecologically grown beef. They give tons of money to renewable energy research at Stanford University, which is their alma mater. And many people, in fact, speculate that Steyer, who is now very much involved in the Democratic machine, a major fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, is eyeing up the possibility of being the Democratic candidate for the governorship of California. He certainly has the money to make that possible. But interestingly, part of that campaign centers around his high position in a bank that's called Beneficial State Bank, which was first called First Californian Bank. And this is a bank located in downtown Oakland, and that is also he runs with his wife, Kat Taylor, that claims to have an enlightened mission, an enlightened green capitalist mode of operation. Yes, it's a bank, but it's a bank with what they call a social license. It's part of this new wave of social enterprises that don't get rid of the profit motive, but suggest to their customers and suggest to the public that they are, you know, a beneficial gift to the community. So Beneficial State Bank gives a great deal of money, or claims to give a great deal of money, to sort of green capitalist causes, to local urban gardens, to sustainable ventures. They also offer sort of informal types of lending and new types of lending to immigrant communities and to poorer communities. But also it's important to note that Beneficial State Bank is still a bank. And in fact, SMC, the company that we spoke about earlier that's participated in gentrification, and many of the clients to whom they sold foreclosed and flipped homes got their new mortgages from Beneficial Bank. So they are also very much participants in this system of gentrification. And we zoom out and look at the whole network of capitalist relations we've identified with Farallon Capital, with Tom Steyer and his political connections, with his wife Kat Taylor and Beneficial State Bank, with SMC, we see that while capitalist enterprises can present a sort of green face to their activities when they choose to do so, we need to be extremely wary and see that as long as we live in a society in which some people get to control vast, vast quantities of wealth, we should not simply be satisfied with them giving us a few crumbs back, even if they've got green food coloring on them. So for us, visiting this home was an opportunity to think through these sorts of questions and to, again, sort of zoom out and see the whole process at work at once.
The walking tour wrapped up in front of a community garden in Oakland, near where, if you know the city, San Pablo Avenue hits West Grand Avenue.
This garden is called Africa Town, and it is a sort of parallel project to the Quilombo Community Social Center. Quilombo was founded in 2011 and is a collaboration between anarchists and many members of the West Oakland black community that has been sort of staged as a holdout against gentrification, a hub for organizing against the continued theft of the neighborhood and the value that people there have created. And the garden itself is being used to grow a whole variety of crops and to teach children and everyone in the neighborhood more about how to become self-sufficient. Quilombo itself is named after a maroon community in Brazil where enslaved people and indigenous people escaped the tyranny of colonialism to form their own community. It's a sort of mythic place in history and in the history of social movements and anti-colonial movements. And we thought it would be an excellent place to end for two reasons. The first is that Colombo really represents an attempt to take a just and poetic revenge in some ways against the system of racial capitalism that has given rise to the forces of gentrification, that has allowed invasive species like hedge funds to thrive and allowed them to continue the work of colonialism into a new century through the use of financial apparatuses. So Quilombo for us really represents a hopeful seed of some new type of invasive species, what those in power will label as an invasive species, but is in fact a new way of living together, a new form of common growth. And it's no coincidence, as you would well imagine, that Quilombo and Africa Town is located on land presently claimed by none other than Neil Sullivan of SMC Homes and his backers at Farallon and Beneficial State Bank. And it's significant that over the last several years, Quilombo, because they've been able to cultivate a wide community of support and solidarity, has managed to fight off several eviction notices and still hold on, rooted in that community, and really hold down that area so that something else can grow.
As our conversation about the tour came to a close, I asked Max Haven about a broader project he's involved in called the University of the Phoenix.
The University of the Phoenix is an umbrella organization through which Cassie and I collaborate on radical alternative financial literacy. In the lead up to and the wake of the financial crisis, this idea of financial literacy was offered to the public as a means to privatize what was in fact a social problem. And the social problem was that people who didn't own stocks and weren't part of the 1% were poor. But it was instead of pointing out that this came from systemic and structural problems within capitalism, instead, we were told that people were financially illiterate, that they didn't know how to manage their money, and financial literacy education was sold to the public in schools and in community centers as an answer to this problem. For us, financial literacy is a really important thing, but the way it's typically taught, we think, is harmful. And we want to teach financial literacy in much more profound ways that allow people to understand financialization and debt, you know, at a political level and also at the level of their own lives and their own bodies. So the University of the Phoenix offers classes in alternative financial literacy. It's also a opportunity for us to build collaborations and offer education with and for the dead. We're interested in the ways that the ghosts of the past haunt the present and the way that we can invite those ghosts into the classroom, both as teachers for the living and as learners themselves, because our hope is that the dead will rise up in vengeance against the system of capitalism and the system of patriarchy and white supremacy, which has led to so much suffering of their descendants. So we have an interest in seances, the paranormal. We have an interest in working with the dead in a profound way in order to try and cast a new light on the timescales and processes of the capitalist present. And finally, the University of the Phoenix, like any good for-profit university, offers its faculty as consultants. And Cassie and I both operate as revenge consultants. We hope to work with a wide variety of community groups and artistic spaces and beyond in order to be able to work with people to figure out what kinds of revenge might be possible that don't simply end in violence and heartbreak and terror, but instead end in the growth of new species of resistance, invasive species, indigenous species. This is the ambition of this umbrella project under which we're organizing a whole variety of different activities.
That's Max Haven, spelled H-A-I-V-E-N. talking mostly about a walking tour he co-conducted last fall. In the time we have remaining, I want to present some of what Max said during an appearance on this program in 2014. Here he talked about the financial sector and specifically the impact of financial sector logic on everyday life.
I think once we begin to understand financialization in a broader scope, we can begin to see its traces all over the place. I mean, I'm a university teacher and quite involved in the politics of the university. So one of the places I see it most frequently is in the way that students, parents, governments, and university administrators increasingly have come to understand education as a quote-unquote investment. And we hear this sort of nauseating rhetoric all the time, that students shouldn't expect that governments will pay for their education, but instead that they should, you know, take out a loan and leverage that debt, that financialized debt, in order to buy a credential, university education, which they'll then be able to go on to the job market and sell back to recoup their costs. Of course, this comes at a time when in the United States alone, student loan debt has topped $1 trillion, and when default rates and delinquency rates on student loan debt are skyrocketing. And in fact, many new reports are emerging to indicate that the weight of the student debt on younger generations is fundamentally eroding and undermining their life chances. They're putting off having families, buying homes, becoming, economic members of society because of the weight of this debt. And this is, I think, symptomatic of a much deeper shift in our society. As this neoliberal ideology takes hold, we're all encouraged to see ourselves as individual competitive agents rather than any form of collectivity. We're no longer encouraged to see ourselves as citizens who care for one another, let alone something more that I would like to see, which is as commoners, as people who are fundamentally dependent on one another, who create common forms of wealth and common forms of community care. All of that's pushed aside in favor of this idea that we should all sort of see ourselves as miniature Donald Trump. And of course, Donald Trump is an excellent example of precisely how this sort of ideology enters into the mainstream and popular culture. The popular show The Apprentice, which has been on, you know, for many years and was really organized around his persona, really attempts to show us what the exalted neoliberal financialized subject looks like. One who has no compulsion about betraying one's friends and allies. One who ruthlessly competes to outperform one's peers. This is the image that's held up to all of us now. And so another example, for instance, is the incredible popularity of home renovation television, reality television shows, where the idea is you're going to go out and buy a home not because you have a commitment to community, not because you want a roof over your head, but because you want to use it as a financial asset that you can leverage for greater gain in the future. And this idea has really seeped out and saturated throughout all of society, so that increasingly we're talking about everything as investments. There are a plethora now of relationship advice books which advise the reader to understand themselves not as a lover or a friend or a companion, but as an investor in relationships. There's advice books that encourage parents to educate their children as savvy financial investors, to see the family as a corporation that needs to be managed as you would manage Goldman Sachs. This is extremely dangerous, and it's dangerous not only in the sense that it normalizes the neoliberal paradigm of individualistic competition, but it also valorizes really the worst elements of our human nature, in a sense, and it fundamentally privatizes our sense of the future. So if we can no longer rely on one another to provide for our futures, then it all just becomes the competitive work of the individual. For instance, as we allow pensions and old age security to increasingly be privatized and downloaded onto the individual, we become increasingly adept at attempting to get as much as we can for ourselves. And of course, the irony here is that the more and more that we invest in privatized savings, the more and more we invest in the United States in, for instance, 401k plans, or in other countries in highly privatized forms of retirement savings, those funds are actually being used and leveraged by major investment banks and others in order to undermine the economy that we live in. It is precisely those sorts of funds that are investing in private equity firms, in hedge funds, in major investment banks, which are doing the neoliberal and financialized works of dismantling the economy as we know it.
Max Haven is an organizer and writer who teaches at Lakehead University in Canada, where he directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab. His books include Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, and Cultures of Financialization, Fictitious Capital in Popular Culture and Everyday Life. And he's currently working on a book tentatively titled Art After Money, Money After Art: Radical Creative Strategies Against Financialization. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.